Top Project family, we're partnering with an amazing brand called Viori. Now, Andrew, can you tell me your favorite piece of Viori clothing?
Yeah, dude, I was so shocked when I pulled out the Strato Tech Tee. I was like, okay, cool. And Seema's been talking about it. Mark's been talking about it. This was my first experience. And when I pulled it out, I'm like, oh, like there's some, this is different. Uh-huh. I know this is gym apparel, like this is performance apparel, but I was like, I don't want to mess this up, but obviously it can handle it. So that for me, dude, that was like the biggest eye opening thing. I was like, okay, now I get it. You know, yeah. What about you? What's your favorite piece?
Well, I love the Strato Tech Tee because I'm wearing the Strato right now. I love the Ponto short because the Ponto shorts, like I wear those to chill at home, but I can also wear those to work out. But the feeling, like I have two of this same exact t-shirt, one 2XL that I wear during podcasts and stuff. And the XL I wear during working out, but I have two. Because it's just so, and this is the last thing I'm going to mention, right? The colors, bruh, they have so many sick colors that you just don't see in other workout gear. Mm-hmm. I dig it so much. Andrew, how can the people get it?
Yeah, you guys got to head over to viori.com/powerproject. And when you do, you're going to get 20% off this amazing performance apparel. This is second to none. You can put them in comparison with the absolute most expensive, most popular brands, and Viori is going to beat them out. So again, that's viori.com/powerproject, viori.com/powerproject. Links to them down in the description, as well as the podcast show notes. Head over there right now.
Power Project family, this episode's going to come with some heat. So with that being said, here's a medical disclaimer. Mark Bell's Power Project podcast does not contain medical advice. We are not doctors, nor are the featured guests. The contents of this podcast, such as videos, text, graphics, images, and other material, are intended for entertainment, informational, and educational purposes only, and not for the purpose of rendering medical advice. The contents of this podcast are not intended to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, nor treatment. Although we make efforts to keep medical information on our channel updated, we cannot guarantee that the information on our channel reflects the most up-to-date research. Consult your physician for medical advice. Always seek the advice of a physician or other qualified healthcare providers regarding a medical condition. Never disregard or delay seeking professional medical advice or treatment because of something you heard on a podcast. Before taking any medications, over-the-counter drugs, or supplements for herbs, consult a physician for a thorough evaluation. This podcast does not endorse any medications, vitamins, or herbs, nor do we condone the use of illegal drugs or using drugs for an unintended purpose. A qualified physician should make a decision based on each person's medical history and current prescriptions. Enjoy.
Sean, what the hell is going on, buddy?
Hey, I'm here absorbing all the good vibes. You know, I mean, what can I say? This is world class, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What's with this beast that you got here with you?
I mean, this is just
you're
what
claiming this guy is yours?
It's what I shoot out, man. Damn, it's perfection.
Damn. Best swimmer.
He won.
The best swimmer.
There double breaststroke.
Damn, you're pretty athletic, and I saw the dance moves on Instagram, and I ain't gonna lie, man. Did you see the dance moves?
I didn't. That's what I'm about to look up right now.
Motherfucker's got moves on top of moves. I don't even know what to call half that stuff, but it was impressive.
Like father, like son.
Oh, shit. You've been hiding all that?
Like I said. It's how I shoot them out, man.
Damn.
Replicas. No, I mean, he's amazing, man, you know, and this is just, it's the culture in our household as well, you know. Ever since he was a kid, I would, you know, even if we go to the grocery store or something, like, when nobody's looking, I'm, like, trying to hit him with the cart and shit, and just run around, and then when adults are looking, I'm like, hey, stop, you know. So he has that good balance of being able to, you know, play it straight at the right time and then also act silly, have a good time.
I understand. If he can handle his dad, he can handle anything.
That's right. That's right? A fact.
Yeah, that's like growing up. I grew up with two older brothers, and they were always messing with me. Mm-hmm. I just grew up crying every day, crying. Now it's a lot harder to make me cry because they beat the crap out of me so much.
It's like my younger brother.
Get all those tears out.
Yeah. Get them out early on.
And are you from St. Louis originally, or is that where you
were born and raised in St. Louis? Yeah.
That ain't easy living out there in some of those spots. I've been out there to visit First Form, and I remember they were telling me, they're like, just stay in your hotel.
Yeah, be careful. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, I was like, oh, where should I go? What should I do? They're like, you should just stay in your hotel. I was like, okay, all right. I'll take your advice since I've never been here before.
Because we don't have a lot of prominent rappers, you know, shout out to Nelly, though. I mean, the time is kind of, you know, the sun has come down on that, but you know, we often people don't hear the fact that
we got some coffee delivery going on.
Amazing,
here.
Amazing. St. Louis has been the murder capital of the United States several times.
Damn. You know,
and so just growing up in that environment, most of my adult life, actually.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Wow. Thank you so much.
We just had coffee dropped off from the heavens.
You know, you're the first person to bring me coffee, like, in my life.
Oh, man.
What?
I didn't tell you this. Yeah. I mean, what? I didn't drink coffee most of my years.
Oh, yeah. I brought you coffee.
Yeah.
That's right.
You went to the cafe.
I went to Bulletproof.
I don't know if we're dropping names here. Yeah. So you went to Bulletproof.
Yeah.
And I had never had somebody bring me coffee, you know, so that's when I fell in love with you. Yeah, man. So anyways.
That explains the text messages. Wow. In the middle of the night, man. Holy cow.
Not expecting you up?
What you doing, bro? I'm trying to sleep. It's 2 a.m.
So most of my life, I lived in Ferguson, Florissant, which Ferguson has become kind of infamous. But when I lived there, I was going to University of Missouri, St. Louis. So I was commuting in and just trying to find a way to get out of the environment that I was in, and also to be able to help change the environment that I come from. So, you know, a lot of great, and also I lived in what's called a quote food desert. And so I didn't know that
for us.
Sure.
We've talked a little bit about that before on the show, but for those that don't know,
these are these cute political labels that are put on things to make it sound not as virulent, you know, because a food desert basically means I didn't have access to high quality food. I was inundated, surrounded by fast food and processed food companies. And
this is liquor stores and stuff like that too, right?
As soon as I walk out my apartment complex, the first thing I see is a liquor store. And then across from that, there's Lee's Chicken, there's Dairy Queen, Papa John's, Domino's, Chinese food, but not like the Chinese food, like a nice Chinese restaurant. It's like Bulletproof Glass, you know, like extra MSG. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every fast food place you can name under the sun within a mile and a half radius of my house. I'm not exaggerating at all. And so, of course, that's what I'm going to eat. That's all I knew. And I didn't know that it was a difference. I just thought that it was just food. It's just stuff you eat. Mm-hmm. It was cheap. And this is a big part of my work the last few years, is to help to explain and educate people on how can something so cost intensive. I actually just taught this to my youngest son. He's 10 years old yesterday. The economies of scale and how a burger. And I just asked him, what goes into making a McDonald's cheeseburger? A double cheeseburger, because that's what I used to get, 99-cent double cheeseburger. He was like, 2 burger patties, cheese, bread, mustard, ketchup, onions. And then I was just like, do they just put the burger together and then like hand it to you? He's like, no, they put in something. They wrap it. There's wrapping. There's a paper that they give to you, a bag. There's a napkin. All this stuff goes into it. A lot of moving parts to make something that ends up being 99 cents. Mm-hmm. Versus, I pointed over to an avocado we had on the shelf that's $2.50. I'm just like, I can get 2 double cheeseburgers that cost a lot to make. They're very cost intensive with a lot of moving parts. These things fall off the fucking tree and it's $2.50. How is that possible? And what it really boils down to is, here in the United States, a lot of folks don't realize this, but we have government subsidy programs that provide billions, billions and billions of dollars every year for farmers to produce these cash crops that largely show up through the drive-through window. And so we know that our government, which means us, we're paying for it. They're investing in low quality food being served in low income communities primarily. Now, here's the question. Do we have data showing that this actually makes people sicker? And so in my latest book, I actually detailed a study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. They tracked the consumption of people who ate the most government subsidized foods. People who ate the most government-subsidized foods had a 40% increase incidence of being obese. Mm. So we know for a fact that the way that our government is structured—
That's a large percentage considering, you know, the state of America in general anyway.
That's it. You know, our society is feeding the problem. Mm. And then pointing the finger at people who are overweight or obese, like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, get off your ass, you're lazy, all these different things.
It's confusing for some people. They're like, well, I don't understand. These people don't have that much money. How are they gaining so much weight?
Yeah.
But it's like they have access to an insane amount of calories, and the foods that they're eating, they taste really good.
That's it.
And so you overeat just by eating a very small amount of food.
That's right. You know, my mother, so literally one place that we lived, I lived right next door to a crack house. It was like across the alley. There's like a little alleyway, a little pathway. And then there's a 4-family flat, and one of them was where, you know, they're making crack and selling. And so I lived in a 2-family flat. But also, this was one of the most incredible times of my life as well. Just, there's so much creativity, you know, like the whole basketball crate, you know, all this, like it was so much fun being in this environment, but we didn't have much, but we kind of don't know in a sense. And so my mom being in this state of poverty, if she's got $20 to feed three kids and herself and my stepfather, we're not going to get an organic rotisserie and some fresh, you know, zucchinis and shit like that. Like we don't, literally you can't afford that, but you could feed everybody, get a full belly and have money left over if you take that $20 to McDonald's, you know? So it's just economically makes sense if you're going to survive.
And going to McDonald's is probably kind of fun.
Exactly.
Because like everybody likes it.
Man, right? I had my birthday party. One of my most memorable events of my life was that McDonald's birthday party. And now here's the thing though. Have you ever thought about how fucking creepy McDonald's is? Like really?
Oh, Ronald McDonald, he's a fucking pervert for sure.
You know what I mean? Like it.
And then that purple thing, whatever that is.
His name is literally Grimace. That's pain. That means pain. You know, Thanos, like a reverse Thanos.
And he's a fat blob, big fat purple blob.
And then they've got the Hamburglar. They got a criminal on their staff. He's a convicted felon. It's just like, you can't make this shit up, man.
Did any of you guys play at McDonald's as a kid? Like, remember when they had like
the ball pit
and stuff?
Yeah, the playhouse.
I played in that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I took this kid to fast food all the time.
Well, in college, like, was that what you studied in college? Was it nutrition stuff? Like, how'd you get into, like, you're the number one nutrition podcast.
Yeah.
So how did you get into learning about all that? And why specifically did you get into focusing on nutrition?
Yes, great question. So when I went to college initially, so I graduated in 3 years of high school, but not by choice. I got kicked out for a year. And I got accepted to every university I applied to, but I had two young kids. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I had my daughter, but then, you know, he was coming shortly thereafter. And so I went to a private university that was close to St. Louis, in St. Charles, the city over. Mm-hmm. And I went pre-med because of television. Like, I didn't know anybody who was a doctor except, like, when I go to the doctor. I didn't see any of that in my environment. Mm-hmm. But I did that because I thought it was the right thing to do to be successful. But the thing is, I hated science. Like, I mean, I hated it. Mm-hmm. I just didn't understand, like, why does this matter? Why are we, like, dissecting a fucking worm? Like, none of that. Like, I didn't like biology, human anatomy, and physiology. There wasn't any connective tissue for me, which was actually a really great gift. And what it was it was the way that I was taught. That's the thing. And so when I went to this university, I was experiencing a lot of suffering because I hated going to class. And so I just got out of it and I shifted over because of TV again, because of a movie called Boomerang, Eddie Murphy Boomerang. Do you remember that?
That's a great movie.
That's a great movie. And he was in marketing.
He's got a weird thing about feet in that movie, right?
Mm-hmm. I didn't see it.
Yeah, the hammer toe. He had the hammer toes, hammer time in her shoes.
He hooks up with like some seriously hot women and a couple of them have like weird feet and he's like,
can't do it. I can't do it. She has a bunion. So, but he was in marketing. So I was like, I'll do that. So that was the kind of representation I would see. You know, even when I went pre-med, it's because of the Cosby Show, to be honest. I didn't want to drop names, you know, because who knows what's going on there. But anyway, so as all of this is taking place, I have a massive breakdown in my own health. And I was going to the university gym, like doing these late night lifting sessions, and I looked fit, but I was literally making my body out of fast food. Like every meal that I ate was fast food or
and
fast
still
food like from the cafeteria.
At that time?
Yeah. I looked fit. You know, I had a six pack, that whole thing, but I was made out of just the worst possible shit. And that's the thing that folks, this is a very foundational understanding for everybody to take on, is that every single cell in your body is made from what you put in there. You get to make your body out of these materials. The human body is incredibly resilient. It will take whatever you put in there and try and figure that shit out. But because of this, I was diagnosed with this degenerative disc disease. So my discs were just rapidly deteriorating. I broke my hip at track practice just from running, you know, because my bone density was so low. And my doctors were just like, you know, I'm sorry, this is incurable. I'm sorry this happened to you. Like this whole kind of standard of care. Here's some drugs, bed rest. I'm sorry, you're going to have to live with this. And I got a second and third opinion, but it was the same bill of goods. And what got me into this field and where I am today, and I'm so grateful that happened. It was the worst time of my life. I lived in Ferguson. Mattress was on the floor. You know, at this point, I had two kids. He'd sleep on an air mattress that had a hole in it. Like, you go to tell them about that.
Yeah, I go to sleep with my sister on the floor on the air mattress, and I'll wake up leaning against her because she was so much bigger, and the air mattress would all be leaned to one side.
So he's basically collapsed on the floor in the morning, you know. And so just trying to get
shoulders all falling asleep and stuff, you know, kind of stuck in one position, right?
And so, you know, having that experience where I'm told that you have this so-called incurable condition, and I didn't realize this, and this is just a little psychology piece, and you know about this, how powerful our minds are. Like, this is how you build all the things that you have, you know, it's your mind first. But physiologically, you know, a lot of folks have heard of the placebo effect, but we don't really understand, like, in randomized placebo-controlled trials, the gold standard of clinical trials, we have to account for the placebo working. The fake drug, the fake treatment, a sham surgery. We've got data on all this stuff showing that on average, placebos are about 33% effective in clinical trials. So somebody believing that this is going to lower their blood pressure, normalize their blood sugar, reduce their symptoms of depression, break down their cancer tumor, the list goes on and on. And if anybody wants to look up a good, like, kind of concentrated book on it, Mind Over Medicine by Dr. Lisa Rankin. But anyway, so the placebo effect is kind of getting a positive injunction that something beneficial is going to happen.
There's even like phantom surgeries where they will slice someone open and not do anything.
Yep.
And the person feels that they're healed.
Yep. And it clinically, they can actually see like their meniscus actually repairs, for example. And we've got data on all this stuff. It's crazy because of the power of the human mind. Now that can even sound very superficial, but your mind literally creates your brain, for example. They're not the same thing. There's a governing kind of meta thing that every thought you're thinking is creating your brain. It's creating your physical tissue. And every thought you think releases correlating chemistry. So right now, we can get into a place where we get really stressed and we start releasing more adrenaline and cortisol just because of the way we're thinking. Or we can shift our thoughts and start to think of things that are more affirmative and joyful and start to change that chemistry. We'll start releasing more oxytocin. Like right now, if we're vibing, we're in oxytocin. You know, women do oxytocin very well, for example. And this is just another one of those things that helps women to live longer, you know. But here's the point. Besides the placebo effect, there's the nocebo effect. And this is one of the most important understandings of our lifetime. Because right now, with all that's going on in the world, a lot of folks aren't aware that some of the biggest fields of medicine are psychoneuroimmunology, how your psychology affects your immune system, and psychoneuroendocrinology, how your psychology affects your hormonal cascade. And so a nocebo effect is when you get a negative injunction from an authority figure. So for example, my doctor told me that I went in, I was just having a nuisance of a pain, like my leg wasn't working because of sciatic pain. And after he tells me this is incurable and I have this condition that's, I'm never going to get better, I went from a nuisance of a pain to chronic debilitating pain like a week later. And I've been dealing with that for like 2 months. And what happened was, isn't this nocebo effect. You'll never walk normally again. People, and in my clinical practice, people come in, you know, I've even heard this before. People getting told, you know, you got 6 weeks to live. You know, you'll never walk again. This is incurable. And if you take that in from an authority figure, and I'm going to give, actually, let me give a tangible example, because this can also sound very, you know, meta. Dr. Alia Crum out of Stanford University, she did this prick test, all right? So I'm just saying prick test because we're on the Mark Bell podcast, all right? But a skin prick test. And so it was to get a histamine reaction in test subjects. And so they gave them this kind of, this skin prick, and it created this rash. And so what they did was they gave the patients one of two different messages. One set of people were told, we're going to give you this cream that's going to help the rash to go away. The other folks were told, we're going to give you this cream that's going to make the rash worse, right? So an agonist and an antagonist, all right? And so now here's the thing. The cream was completely inert. It had no therapeutic benefit whatsoever. But the people who were told that it's going to make the rash get better, their rash got better within 10 minutes. They were told this by a reputable physician, right? Somebody that they believed. And other folks who were told that this is going to make your rash worse, it got worse within 10 minutes.
Was it like a certain percentage of the people that were told, or all the...
Every single person. It was a spectrum on how much changed, but everybody had a change in the direction that they were given this injunction.
Woo!
Now, here's the key. the magnitude of how much it changed was based on how much the person felt that the doctor was competent. How much they trusted the doctor is how much their skin changed, right? So that's the nocebo effect. It's getting it from an authority figure. Who's the big authority figure right now for most folks? It's their television. You know, it's their favorite news personality. They've got a, even though the so-called trust of the news is at an all-time low, that's superficial because there's a gateway open in people's minds for people who they deem to have the answers, and it just bypasses your logic.
We almost have a little bit of like back to your food desert thing where you could say, hey, look, a lot of these people in a food desert, they have choices. And you're like, well, no, not like, okay, maybe. Maybe they kind of sort of have choices, but not really. And I think the same thing would be true with the news. Like, yeah, you could just ignore the, but like, who's actually got the power to ignore the news? Like, you need to be a powerful, healthy person who's already maybe studying stuff, who's already maybe a little bit ahead. It's hard to be that person to be like, no, I'm not going to listen to not only the news, but any of the news. Yeah. And then any of the stuff that comes from social media that might make you panic, that might make you feel a certain type of way.
Absolutely. It's kind of like a detox has to take place. Because what would happen is people, they're like, well, yeah, the news, there's a lot of bullshit here. It's a lot of, you know, lying, manipulation, fear. But I got to stay informed. You know, like I'm just watching for the weather. That's what I would do. But next thing you know, you're roped in, you know. And so, but here's where everything changed. So after 2 years of suffering, and I gained a lot of weight, and I was in such pain that I was literally afraid of getting up off my couch, which he knows is my, I had this little love seat, which I can't even call it a couch if you can carry it by yourself.
You're like,
but part of the side that I sat in broke through. My fat ass like broke it. And so I had like pillows under there, and I would still have girls open. Never mind. It was just like, anyways, so it got to that place where I gained all this weight and I didn't recognize a person I saw in the mirror. And it was kind of this moment, this epiphany happened. I was really at rock bottom. And I had saw this, I seen this last physician who somebody recommended, he's going to help me. He told me the same thing. And so at this point, all of these folks are telling me I can't get better. And I realized that I've been outsourcing my potential to these people who don't walk in my shoes. They mean well. They're telling me what is based on their clinical experience. But I hadn't done anything myself to get better. And what I did was I realized, and this is so simple, but most people miss this. When I realized this, I just made a decision. I just made a decision to get better. I just decided. And when I did that, it wasn't just, again, like the clouds parted and just like everything got better instantaneously, but I decided and then I moved in that direction. Like the next day, I got up and went to the gym for the first time in those 2.5 years. And I could barely walk correctly. So I just went to the stationary bike. It was hard. It was embarrassing. You know, the next week I just, you know, I got on the elliptical, did a little walking. And the next week I picked up a few dumbbells. And that was the low hanging fruit.
Where do you think that resilience came from to have that mindset? Because some people, they don't ever get out of that stuck mindset. Was it growing up in kind of a tough neighborhood, or was it your parents, or what do you think?
It was my
grandmother. Gave you that resilience.
It was my grandmother. The first part of my life, I lived with her, you know, in a, quote, good neighborhood. And she just immersed me in all these beautiful things. It was safe, you know, a lot of certainty. Versus when I moved in with my mother, you know, it was a lot of violence. You know, I wake up in the morning, there's blood on the floor, people fighting, you know, and a lot of abuse of all types. And in that environment with my grandmother, she instilled in me, that's where I fell in love with learning. And now I've got these two massive best-selling books, which is crazy. And it started from me sitting at this table with her with this little Garfield writing book. And I'm just like, I can make whatever I want. I could just say whatever I want. And falling in love with education then. And this is why, and to answer your question, she led me to believe that I was going to do something remarkable with my life. Even when I went to that other environment, which she, man, I know that broke her heart to be there. She always, I just felt like I was carrying the potential of my family to break all these patterns on me. And now here I was in this apartment by myself, like can't even recognize who I am. And I had forfeited all this shit. And then I realized like, no. Because all this time my grandmother was still calling me, being a grandmother, like, just basically bothering me. I'm like, I'm fine, grandma, I'm fine. But I was not fine, you know. And I realized that all the greatness that she saw in me, it was up to me to access it. And I'd already fought through so much to get to this point. So that's really what it was. You know, I felt like I had somebody counting on me. I had people that were counting on me. You know, I wanted to be an example for him. And so I just took that as my thrust and motivation. And once you do that, when you really make a decision with like that, there's no other possibility. Like, I cannot fail. And so, you know, cut to, it was actually 6 weeks later, which the results not typical. I lost about 18 pounds in 6 weeks. But I was always kind of the thinner guy in my family. A lot of obesity in my family. I was like the skinny kid. But my, you know, there's the FTO gene. There's all these different genes associated with, you know, obesity. But it definitely kicked on for me. And now the weight just flew off of me. So the movement was one thing. But the game changer, there's two, was changing my nutrition. My first logical idea was like, okay, I've got this degeneration happening with my spine and pain. What if I lose some of this weight? Take some of the pressure off my back. But then I asked a simple fundamental question. Okay, if my bones are deteriorating, my disc, what are they made of? All I knew about was calcium from commercials and shit, you know? And so I was in college still, and I just went to the school computer lab and I just started to research. There was like 30 or 40 other things that the bones are made of, require in order for bone density, and many of them more important than calcium. Calcium just had marketing, you know? And none of these things, like I was getting like two of those things in my drive-through diet. And so I just started to, the first thing, just to be honest, I became a natural pill popper. I was like, I need to supplement this supplement. Very expensive for my broke ass, first of all. But, you know, I saw some results. But then shortly thereafter, I asked, okay, what foods can I find all these things in? And then I just start to flood my body with all of these nutrients. And so now I'm making my body out of sustainable materials, right? So my disc, for example, you know, sulfur-bearing amino acids, omega-3s, hydration. Your discs are mostly water, but here's the crazy thing about your disc. Your discs don't get hydrated directly. They get hydrated through a process called remote diffusion. Okay. And so essentially, this is also why just through the day, you actually lose height because of gravity. Like, so the discs kind of get dehydrated. And so in order for your disc to get fully kind of hydrated and access all the water that is available, kind of your discs are like a lower tier of priority for your body. You have to, its priority is your blood, your brain. Your brain is like 80% water. So you have to provide your body with enough hydration that it can even like get to your disc. And I honestly, and I think, again, you hear this stuff like you can only go a certain amount of time without water. I've disproven this shit. I was drinking like maybe a glass of water a day and like Hawaiian punch. You know what I mean? Wow. Yeah. Like, and this was just my normal. And then, of course, there's sometimes you're just thirsty as a motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Maybe every couple of days, I might just down a bunch of water.
But also, when you don't know, like, you'll drink, like, a Slurpee. And you'll think, like, that's going to hydrate you or something.
But you're still doing a little bit of working out, too, at this point, right? So you were...
Yeah, so now I'm moving. And now I'm bringing in higher quality raw materials. Okay. And this was the key. I came across a study that was done on racehorses looking at increasing bone density. And so they had a test group of horses. And... basically, you know, this is a crazy business, by the way. I don't know if you guys know anything about the horse race. It's like a $1 billion whole thing. And so if a horse breaks their leg, like you can lose tens of millions of dollars in profits. And so they had the study group. I mean, they had the control group who did nothing to the horses. Then they had a study group that gave them supplements like I was taking. And they that did increase their bone density. But then they had another group. And this was missing the study. They walked the horses and gave them nutrition. They had an even higher increase in their bone density. That's what exercise, one of its primary functions. The side effect is physique, but exercise is really about assimilation of nutrients. And the word exercise is very close to the word exorcise, right? So it's just like to get things out of you in a sense, like an exorcism,
okay.
You know? So it's just like also detoxification is literally required movement. If you're not moving, your body is just like a cesspool. And so now that I'm moving and bringing in these nutrients, my assimilation goes up. And then the final piece was, once I started doing all this good stuff for myself during the day, my sleep got better. The worst part in that 2.5 years was my sleep, because it was literally a nightmare. I can only sleep a couple of hours and I'm waking up in pain. Mm-hmm. And so I was taking all these medications, stuff that's like even kind of pulled off the market now, you know, for like arthritic conditions and sleep pills. But it was like a pseudo sleep. And so once my sleep got better, man, I got better so fast.
I got to mention this, or people need to know. I read your book, Sleep Smarter, years ago. And that was an amazing book. It taught me a lot about sleep. But what's the other book that you mentioned? I didn't know you had another book out.
Yeah, my latest book is Eat Smarter.
Eat? Okay.
Yeah.
So, cool.
So, and by the way, and I'm honored to say this now, we're actually here at a year that it came out in a couple of weeks as of this recording. The week that it came out, it was the number one new release in the United States.
Damn.
Whoa.
Yeah. For a couple of days, and it sold out. And so it was like on the list with like the Obamas and like Matthew McConaughey and all this.
Hell
and then,
yeah.
Then there was this book on food and nutrition from this kid from Ferguson, Missouri. You understand? Like, yeah. It's so beautiful, man. It was so inspiring because all this happening in the world, it gave me another affirmation that people care about this. We might not know, because in my clinical practice, I never met one person who didn't want to be healthy. They might have a story in their mind that they can't because of fill in the blank. They might have developed learned helplessness because of failures in the past. Everybody wants to feel good, you know? And so to put the cherry on top of the story, once I started getting better and I was still at my university, people started coming up to me. Literally, it was like that. And I know you've had this happen. And so my professors would multiple times stop me on the way out of class, like, what did you do? And I'm just like, what the fuck did I do? Like, you know? And they're like, you look so healthy. I didn't look like a guy who just lost weight. I looked like a guy who was healthy. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me if I can help them, you know? And so my professors, fellow students, faculty members at the university, they were all my first clients. And I shifted my coursework back to biology and kinesiology, still miseducated in school, by the way. That education is not accurate. Mm. Most of my education, of course, was through the research that I was doing. And also today, primarily I work as a research scientist. But then I opened my clinical practice as a nutritionist. So I did a lot of consulting work and working with businesses and individuals, working with a lot of chronic diseases. A lot of people told the same story as me. There's nothing you can do about this. Man, on a daily basis, I saw I'm a very science-minded, logical person. Mm-hmm. If I didn't know any better, it would seem like a miracle. You know, like we couldn't even really say that type 2 diabetes was completely reversible. You know, there's so much strange litigation around it. But today it's just common knowledge. Mm. And so what I would do is just teach people how their body works. Here's how your pancreas works, your beta cells and alpha cells. Here's how, you know, your liver is working in operation with, you know, lipogenesis and creating fat, all this stuff. And I would see the light come on in their eyes like, oh shit, I didn't know that was happening to me. I can actually do something about this. But over time, it got to the place where I was doing this every day, and it pulls a lot from you, by the way. But I felt like I need to write this shit down. Like I'm only helping like one person at a time, and it's taking a toll. Let me record this or write it down. And that's when I started my show and writing books.
What year was that the show started? Because it's been going on for a minute.
Yeah, over 8 years ago. But before that, I was the face of another big podcast brand.
Really?
Yeah. So I was speaking at an event because primarily what I did was I ran my clinical practice and I was speaking. Those are the two things that I was doing.
Okay.
And so I did a TEDx talk in Las Vegas. This was probably 2011, maybe.
Wow.
And so this couple came up to me and they had this massive online wellness site. And they said, well, you know, we're just starting a podcast. We think you'd be great. And they told me the numbers they were doing because I had just started my website. And mm-hmm. we have this, like, if you build it, they will come. Ridiculous idea. Nobody's coming to this website. But all my friends were like, who did your website? It's amazing. It doesn't matter if nobody's coming to it. And so they told me they had like 2 million unique visitors a month or whatever it was. And I was like, word? Okay. And I just want to help people. I didn't care about the money part because they ended up making a lot of money from me. Mm. But so I became the face of that brand. We had hundreds of thousands of downloads of that podcast. Back then, it was like a unicorn, you know. But eventually from there, I pivoted and started my own show.
A lot of times you'll hear people say, and I think it's like well-meaning. I think that people are saying this just to labor the point that it's not going to be easy, but you'll hear people often say that there's no magic diet. And I always am like, I don't know about that, man, because I've seen a lot of magical, mystical shit go down when people get on a nutrition plan to where their entire life changes.
Right.
They not only are losing body fat, which sometimes can be crippling in and of itself. I think that like less movement promotes less movement, and success breeds success, and more movement promotes more movement, and so on to a certain extent. But I've seen like all kinds of miraculous things happen where some people, having like Michaela Peterson on the podcast and having other folks come on, and they'll say, yeah, man, my hip, my knee, my foot, my ankle, my this, my that was in tons of pain when I was eating, you know, bagels every day. And you're kind of like, that's bullshit. There's, you're kind of thinking to yourself, like, logically, there's just, come on, gluten can't be that bad, you know, or whatever the hell's in a bagel or whatever. Yeah. You're like, come on, bro, like, quit being a pussy. You're kind of thinking, right. You know, like, it's not possible. But there's so many people that tell you so many things that kind of where it seems like sometimes some of this stuff is like metaphysical or magical. Is that it seems like that's been your experience.
Yeah. There's many paths to the goal, first of all. But food is a powerful one because it is so visceral. You know, like what you eat affects your psychology, right? So it makes it easier to think affirmative things that change your chemistry, right? It all feeds into each other. And so, but it's also so overlooked how powerful food is. And also, you know, it has all of these, I want to give a good example for people. Everything in this room right now came from nature. Somehow, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't look like it at all. There's a fucking sword here, a plastic sword. It doesn't, maybe it's real. For the listeners, it's real.
Don't go picking that up, okay. Swinging around.
Sorry. No disrespect. So everything in this room came from nature. And the same thing with us. Like, as we're looking at each other, I'm seeing what you've eaten. It is that powerful. Like, I'm seeing you're the result of the food that you've eaten, the nutrition you've taken in, or the lack thereof, you know? And so that's how powerful food is. But we don't think about it in that context because in our culture, it's not respected. You know, food is just something it's a social thing, and it's just, and it's often just a pleasure of the mouth type thing, right? Versus our ancestors, they had much closer relationship because they had to fucking work to get their food. That part has been lost in the process to where you don't have to do shit.
Spend a lot of energy to get energy.
That's it. You know, now we don't have to do anything. Literally, you can have the DoorDash person like come right, you know, like, hey, door's open. You don't even have to get up, you know, let alone do any work for it. And so we've lost touch with the relationship with food. And so, of course, we're going to have a big break in our psychology on how food can actually create and change our physiology, right? And so just to hammer this point home, as I mentioned before, when I mentioned the meniscus, the intervertebral disc, your brain is literally made from the food that you eat. Right. So theoretical physicist Michio Kaku, he's like modern day Einstein to a lot of people. He said that the human brain is the most complicated object in the known universe. Right. It's made of fucking food. It's made of food. You know, like
it has macronutrients to it.
That's it. And so I know I just did a lecture for a neuroscience department at NYU mm-hmm. maybe 2 weeks ago. So I know all of these incredible, and that's just one example. I do all this cool stuff now, but I know all these incredible thinkers, these neuroscientists, and they're looking at an organ and studying this organ. They don't even know what they're looking at. I know the top cardiologist in the world. His focus is the cardiovascular system in the human heart, but he's not taught in school that the heart is made from fucking food. Like there's a fundamental break in the understanding. Here's a little interesting thing, for example, epicardial fat, right? We think of the heart as a muscle. Mm-hmm. The heart actually is about 20%. The weight of the heart is 20% fat, all right? Epicardial fat. This is a visceral fat of the heart. Visceral fat. Now, visceral fat is that abdominal, deep abdominal fat, or also known as omentum fat. This is most correlated with chronic disease if you have too much of it. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the heart. This is one of the biggest issues even happening right now with this issue that's going on in a lot of people's minds, this infectious disease, myocarditis, all these different things, is strongly related to epicardial fat. There's a new paper that just came out a couple weeks ago. I just did a show about it. And so the growing of that, by you bringing in abnormal food substances and growing abnormal amounts of visceral fat of your heart, you could die. Not just from this infectious disease, but from all manner of other diseases. You know, and it's based upon what are you making your tissues out of? You know, those specific heart cells are made from the raw materials you give it. Your body will do rob Peter to pay Paul to put together a heart for you. Like, hey, there you go. You know, this is what you got to work with. Or you can give yourself really sustainable and this is the thing about the body too. It will preferentially choose the higher quality stuff whenever you give it the opportunity. The body is so much more, so much smarter than us. And the thing is, what we're doing even right now is that we have this ignorant idea that we are smarter than nature. We're smarter than our bodies. We're not even remotely close. I know a lot about nutrition, for sure. But still, we don't know shit.
Yeah.
Like, there are thousands of different compounds we don't even know that exist right now. And so, you know, it's exciting, but also I think that the greatest teachers in this are always going to be humbled. They're going to realize how little we know, you know, and also bask in the joy of the things that we do know now.
Was your grandmother, was she religious?
Not really.
I sometimes think that some people from kind of long ago, like if you ask grandma about the heart and the brain, mm-hmm. I think she would have information that would be on par with these experts that you're talking
absolutely.
About, just because of like intuition and shit that's been passed down from generation to generation. It's fascinating. I heard Joe Rogan had somebody on his show recently talking about consciousness and like getting into that whole world.
Yeah.
And basically when you start to ask people these questions, you ask like a Neil deGrasse Tyson and some of these experts about things that they've been studying forever, they are usually the most courageous people to say, we actually don't know. Every time it kind of comes back to that same thing. Like the more that you study it, the kind of less that you realize, you're like, man, there's a lot of stuff that is unknown. So I think it's promising in a way that there's a lot of stuff that we don't know, but sometimes it's also kind of disheartening because you're like, man, how do we not know?
Yeah.
We've been studying this shit for so long.
Yeah. That's the beauty of it, you know? And I just want to share this little thing. When you mentioned my grandmother, one thing that she did have me do every night, we had a routine. You know, we say my prayers. You know, I take the bath, say the prayer, this little nighttime song that we would say. And, you know, she tucked me in. There was this consistency. There was a routine. There was certainty attached to it. And another thing that people are struggling with today is a lack of routine, especially when we become adults. And then, like my son here, when you don't have somebody who's like, it's bedtime, Jordan, and then you start to haphazardly have this abnormal structure. Mm-hmm. And then for a lot of people, that gets ingrained for their lifetime, you know, especially with all the stuff we have today to consume, you know, so we don't have that evening routine. And the brain is always looking for patterns as well. And so one of the best ways to improve your sleep quality, now, you know, I work with these folks at Stanford University, all these great scientists, is to just simply create a nighttime routine. Like, we've got our daily success structure, you know, morning routines are popping. People want to know what the morning routine is, success routine. Your evening routine is even more important because it's going to determine what your morning routine looks like, you know, your sleep quality. And so I'm just going to throw this out there for people to think about that. I actually have, and it's not always, I love having my son here because he knows this. My wife is, she's a rule breaker. Like she, even last night, I'm like, babe, you know, it's nine, trying to, you know, wind down, turn things off. She's like, just 10 more minutes, you know, like with this show, you know. And, I have to have the resolve and to stick to this routine. I have an alarm.
Women don't seem to care about a lot of these rules.
Of course. Like, what am I going to do? Like, if she really wants me to, she knows how to get me to do whatever she wants. So, you know, but I have a routine at night to shut down. And I just recommend people do this. Give yourself a screen curfew, right? It's one of the easiest ways you can improve your sleep quality because researchers at Harvard have affirmed just being on your device at night, that blue light, white spectrum, it's not just the blue light, that's kind of what's popularized, but it's signaling your brain, it has not evolved having access to this stuff for you know, eons, for centuries, thousands and thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We had light when it was day and it was dark at night and you had fire, depending on when in evolution we're talking about. So when you are blasting this into your optical receptors in the evening, it's fucking up your circadian timing system. Your brain is like, I don't know what time it is. Like, what is this trying to tell me? It's always trying to sync up. And I said this earlier that psychoneuroimmunology is one of the fastest growing, probably the fastest growing field of medicine is circadian medicine. Looking at how the timing of the day and the timing that you're doing things affects your health. You know, it's fascinating stuff. So if you can give yourself a screen curfew, at least 30 minutes, you know, just give yourself 30 minutes to be off the screens And, you know, maybe this is a time you do a little reading, listen to a podcast. You don't got to stare at a screen to do that. Mm-hmm. Audiobook, talk to somebody, you know, just like maybe you could talk to your significant other. I know it's a lot of pressure, but, you know, like find something else to fill that gap. Yeah. The hardest thing is when you tell somebody to stop doing something that might be harming them and try to replace it with something that is lesser value. You got to find something that you like and that you enjoy to fill that spot with.
Since we're talking about sleep right now, and getting better sleep was one of the biggest things for helping you get better at that time. First question is, you know, people have been going kind of wild about blue light blockers. We use blue light blockers. I noticed it does help me feel a little bit sleepier at that time. But we've also heard some people like Huberman has mentioned that it might not be that big of a deal. I'm curious, do you still feel the same about blue light blockers? And then also, you wrote a whole book on it. So I honestly suggest that people buy that book, Sleep Smarter, because I learned a fuck ton from it. But if you have maybe 3 to 5 biggest tips to be able to improve your sleep quality, what would those be? Just because we know that sleep is like literally the biggest thing for gaining more muscle, helping your hormonal health, recovery, all of that stuff.
What have I been doing for years in the evening as far as the blue light blocking glasses?
I mean, you pop them on every night. They're sitting right there where you sit every single night. You got like 3 pairs for some reason. I don't know why you got 3 pairs.
Is there a specific brand you recommend? There's a lot of brands out
there. He's been through construction glasses that wrap around his head. Tonight he's got like early stylish ones that's just like.
Do you do this since you see him do it so much? Or
being that my dad is considered the sleep guru, ironically, I don't do a lot of the things. I'm going to just say it's a young adult thing, I guess. I don't know.
I feel it. Okay.
Sean, would you agree that maybe there's not a lot of reason to investigate some of this stuff if you don't? Like, he probably just is running well. I mean, he looks extremely healthy. He's working out like a madman with us today.
He has a good barometer as when he needs to check himself, too, because he's experimented so much. I've been there to point out times throughout his life when something happens. Like, you see, this is a result of this. Mm. To, like, push that in so he just has that cognitive association.
Son, I told you to wear those glasses.
Yeah. And he'll call it, like, a week or 2 weeks before something actually bad happens. I don't know how he does it, but, like, a year ago, I got really sick because I wasn't sleeping and I was waking up, like, 5 in the morning to go to the gym. Mm. And he just caught up with me. And he called it, right, like, way before I actually got sick.
Yeah, it was a couple weeks beforehand because I could see it coming. I love the fact they had that dedication. What other, you know, he was like about to be, he was turning 20 at the time. What other 19, 20-year-old kid is getting up at 4:30 and getting to the gym and is about that life and is inspiring people? And just like, it was amazing. But also, my guy, like, you can't be up till 1 though, you know, fucking around with these girls. You know, like, something's got to give, you know? And so, but also there's a joy there. There's a juice that you get by, you know, lifting those weights, you know? And so but because of that, it can blind you to the other part, right? And so, you know, just within this vein, as he mentioned, this is probably what, mae 7, probably I say 7, 8 years ago, I was like, as he mentioned, I was wearing construction glasses like these, you know, and I don't know how my wife dealt with me, but I was always doing these experiments long before these things became in vogue. And actually, a lot of these blue light blocking companies have, of course, like reached out to me and utilize the data that I've been putting out to build their company, like to leverage it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I don't want to recommend any particular brand. Okay. They're all pretty comparable. But really what we're looking at is there's a tremendous amount of anecdotal data. Like you just mentioned, when you put them on, you notice like I get sleepy. Mm-hmm. There's a neuro association there. Something is happening biologically as well, which is wonderful. We don't want to discount that anecdotal data. But as far as peer-reviewed evidence, it's scant. There's a little bit. There is a little bit, though. We mm-hmm. do have a little bit of data. But these are things that are not getting a lot of funding to get tested, to do randomized controlled trials. But so what we're looking at here is, do I think they're effective? I wouldn't do it if I didn't, you know? Yeah. And what it is giving us an opportunity to, of course, like you could still, if you got a little work to do, you could be on your, you know, watch a show, whatever, not take as big of a hit because it's changing. It's like warming the tone of light that you're getting, because what we would have is moonlight or fire. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of simulating fire type color, right? But there's also something to be said to being off the device because of the stimulation of being on the device as well. So it is, I think it's like, it's kind of like protection in a sense, you know, it's like, if you're going to do it, you might as well use some protection, you know, because you don't really know where the internet has been. You know what I mean? You think the internet is faithful to you, but it's definitely out there on the streets. So wear a little bit of protection at night. You get me? And so having that as a strategy also on desktop, I just got a new desktop computer. It's already built in, you know, with the new Mac. You know, they got the screen, the night shift. Night shift. That's it. Night shift. They got night shift. There is.
You talked about that when I was on your show. I think I don't remember if it was when I was on your show, but you mentioned like all this is coming, like you were predicting it back then.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple years ago,
you know. And the thing is, it's a preemptive thing I think from these tech companies because they know it's kind of like I think about the movie Super Size Me, you know, where they start to have lawsuits because McDonald's is making me fat, right? Where again, that's not necessarily true. And in some instances, you know, there is some manipulation going on there. You still have your personal decision, but it's all like a chemical soup. The same thing here. These tech devices are so addictive. And now we have very strong data showing the correlation with sleep disruption and increasing risk of cancer, of increasing risk of cardiovascular disease. So I just shared this the other day. The World Health Organization, who everybody seems to be looking towards right now. So I like to use people's own data. If you really want to listen to them, listen to this. They tracked about 700 men for 14 years to see what would happen if they were consistently sleep deprived. And they found that when men were not getting sufficient amounts of sleep over this 14-year study period, they had twice as many heart attacks as people who got enough sleep and four times as many strokes. All right? There's something absolutely miraculous that sleep does that nothing else can do.
Yep.
You know, and what it is, some of the things is that it's the primary, sleep is the most anabolic state you could be in. Just being awake is catabolic, all right? We can produce and trigger the anabolic secretion of hormones, absolutely, but you get the biggest skeet skeet of HGH when you go to sleep.
Right? Need to start doing this show.
Yeah. Skeet skeet.
That's
so
incredible.
This is the thing, you know, and so if you're not honoring that, and leveraging that, you're missing out.
Yeah.
You're missing out, truly. And so as far as some strategies, tips, what I mentioned about the screen curfew, that's kind of like a pulling off the band-aid. That's a little bit difficult. What I did was in my practice, because I saw it was such a big issue with people coming in, they got their nutrition is on point. They're moving. They're doing a lot of stuff right, but they're not, the weight isn't coming off like everybody else. Or we're not getting their blood sugar normalized, or we can't get them off their lisinopril for their heart, you know, heart disease, whatever it is. And so once I got their sleep dialed in, everything got better. And here's the big takeaway. Knowing all these people I'd worked with at this point, the people want change, but they don't want to change that much, right? So they want change, but they don't want to change that much because they are comfortable with who they are, even if they're not happy with who they are. So I dug into the research to find what are some actionable things people can do to improve their sleep without turning their lives upside down. And so here's a very simple one. Appalachian State University researchers, they did a study to find out what's the best time of day to exercise if you want to improve your sleep quality. And so they had exercisers to train at three different times exclusively, at 7 a.m. for one phase, at 1 p.m. for another phase of the study, and 7 p.m. in the evening for another phase. They found that the morning exercisers spent more time in the deepest, most anabolic stages of sleep. They had more efficient sleep cycles. They tended to sleep longer. And this is often overlooked. I don't talk about this much. These folks had a higher decrease in their blood pressure in the evening, which is correlated with an activation of the parasympathetic nervous system and turning off that fight or flight, all from working out in the morning. This doesn't mean that you can't work out another time, but there's something that happens by you getting up and being active in the morning that is just like your genes expect it of you, right? And this is, if you think about evolutionary biology, what will we be doing? When the sun comes up, you get out, you get busy because you're not going to be fucking around at night because you could die, you know? And so when you do that, you're helping to set your cortisol rhythm, right? So we have we would do certain tests where we could see people's cortisol was elevated in the evening and too high and too low in the morning. We would call them tired and wired. because cortisol is kind of this get up and it's not bad. It's when it's produced at the wrong times and wrong amounts, it can be problematic. But you need cortisol skeeting out in the morning. And so exercise helps that rhythm to get going. So you get that cortisol peak and it can gradually decline as the day goes on. So get yourself some morning exercise, even if it's just 5 minutes. You know, you could do a Tabata. You know, it takes 4 minutes. You know, 20 seconds on, 10 seconds rest. Do some squats or some push-ups back and forth. You could do, you know, do some yoga, go for a power walk. Just do something active in the morning to help to get that cortisol going. So that's number one. Very practical. You could still have a later day workout. That's okay. But take advantage of that cortisol rhythm reset. So that's number one. Very practical. The folks listening to this probably have some form of exercise program already, you know, but get something in the morning. Number two, this is to be 1,000 with you guys. This is the biggest thing. And it's so overlooked. Like, we're not even at a place where society even remotely understands this. None of the things that I'm saying matters if you're not, if you don't have the raw materials to make your sleep-related hormones and neurotransmitters, which is made, again, from food, all right? So if we're talking about serotonin, we're talking about protein structure, amino acid structure. Serotonin is a precursor to making melatonin. Melatonin isn't just a sleep hormone. That's a very rudimentary understanding of it. It is a master regulator of your whole circadian clock, your whole circadian timing system of your body. Melatonin is regulating, controlling a lot of your genes, all right? But serotonin is the opening act for it. It's the precursor to make it. And so, but all of the above are made from amino acids, right? So one of them is tryptophan. And we have clinical trials. This is evidence-based. If you are getting adequate amounts of tryptophan, it is going to improve your sleep quality, right? So what I call these are good sleep nutrients. If you're deficient in any of these things, this can be, you can have the best mattress. You could have your blue light blocking glasses. You can exercise in the morning. If you're deficient in these things, your sleep isn't going to be as good, period. And so what are some of the other ones? So I mentioned tryptophan, but one of the most interesting, and this was published in the Public Library of Science, so PLOS One, vitamin C. Vitamin C is critical for regulating your sleep cycle. So they found that test subjects who were deficient in vitamin C had less efficient sleep cycles, and they tended to have more wake after sleep onset. So they would wake up more frequently during the night. Getting the vitamin C levels up helped to address this. What the fuck can't vitamin C do, man? It's really amazing. You know, Linus Pauling won a Nobel Prize for his work with vitamin C. It's just like it never happened or something. So now here's the thing. You could take another supplement for it, food first. You know, there are great botanical sources of vitamin C. Obviously, we know the generals, the citrus fruits, but also you got to be mindful of sugar for yourself, kiwis, bell peppers, broccoli. But then there's this category of superfoods, which Man, marketers screw everything up, man. Like, everything is not a superfood. But I'm talking about the stuff that has so many benefits, peer-reviewed evidence, that it's just like, this is a game changer. One of those is called Camu Camu Berry, C-A-M-U-C-A-M-U, Camu Camu Berry. It's the highest botanical source of vitamin C ever discovered. And, man, I mean, I can go on and on with the studies. With one of these crazy studies with Camu Camu Berry, they gave rats, like, the worst shit. They just gave rats, like, high fructose corn syrup and soybean oil. Like, that was their diet. Like, the worst shit ever. And they made it taste good so the rats would eat it. And, of course, they developed insulin resistance, obesity, all this stuff. When they gave them Camu Camu Berry, it basically halted these negative effects of insulin resistance. It improved their insulin sensitivity, even eating this shitty food. Whoa. This is a real peer-reviewed, published study, you know? So, yeah, Camu Camu Berry is one of my favorite things. You can get in, like, powder, you know, unless you want to go down to South America and go into the jungle and find some.
So something like this then?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Camu Camu Berry. If you can, of course, try and get it organic, you know, reputable sources.
It's cheap too.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully this one's a good one, I should say.
Well, I mean, I could tell you the kind that I use, but I don't know if we're plugging.
You could tell us all about whatever you'd like.
Okay. So it's Paleo Valley is the company that I get it from.
There you go.
Paleo Valley. Because they don't have any binders, fillers, any of that stuff. It's just a great vitamin. It's called Essential C Formula. They do stuff the right way. And I know that they are listening to my show for years because I talk about camu berry. Amla berry is the second botanical source, and acerola cherry. Those are my three favorites, and they made a formula with that.
Mm. Quick question.
And they didn't pay me.
The tryptophan, did you suggest that people like supplement tryptophan at night or something? Or
food first.
Food first.
That's pretty easy to get from, you know, people know about like turkey.
Yeah.
It's like synonymous, but also, you know, chicken, you're going to get some with, there are some plant sources that have notable amounts of tryptophan, but it's mostly going to be in animal foods.
Gotcha.
So, okay. Yeah, it's not difficult to get tryptophan. But then the thing is some people, if they're being restrictive on their diet and they're not getting in these animal foods, that might be a conflict as far as I'm getting it.
Mm. Gotcha.
Okay. Jordan, how has it been for you? Like, you know, now, like things have worked, you know, mm-hmm. for your dad, things have worked for your family. Mm-hmm. How was it maybe years ago when you guys maybe like weren't over the hump and dad was going into speech mode about like your sleep and food and like, you know, any of these kinds of things? Did you, when you were a teenager, were you maybe like, you know, now you're older, you're more mature, you're probably like, okay, I see what the hell dad's doing. This makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I support it. I'm behind it. This is like what our family does. When you were a teenager, were you kind of frustrated maybe sometimes, or did you tune them out and be like, dad, I just don't need another one of these speeches type thing?
I mean, my dad just let me be a kid, honestly. He made me, let me make my own decisions, let me learn firsthand. So it was really up to me whether or not I followed what he listened. I mean, followed what he said. And I mean, honestly, over time, I started to follow like what he's saying, and I'm still like incorporating it, but he never really like pressured me to do it. I just kind of, the things that I do right, I chose to do versus him like
right
bashing me about it.
Talk about the culture in our house.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the biggest role, is like we all want to be healthy, we all want to do better, we all, and there's certain things you have to do to be that way and get that way, and so it's just like a regular thing in our house, which is a blessing, honestly. So.
And what about like working out? I think your dad mentioned that he took you to the gym like when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And was it just like, hey, like you want to come with me today? And you just kind of popped in with him? And
man, it started back when he was in college, training at the college. I would come with him while he would train clients. And I would want to do it. I wouldn't say anything, but I would want to do it too. And then I remember we were going on vacation once and I was in my room doing like so many push-ups, getting ready for the beach. And I'm like 12 years old. And then he took me to Gold's Gym, like, officially, and I just, like, fell in love with it. Like, I told my middle school teacher, oh, I just deadlifted 135, like.
Nice.
And since then, I just, that's where I want to be, is the gym.
That's a good example for parents, because I think that parents want to, maybe, like, I think as an adult, I think we have maybe false images of the way that we were when we were young. Like now you could say I'm a savage. Like I get a lot of shit done every day and I'm working towards always becoming more successful. And you got like markers of that. And you can see like I've made more money. I have a more successful podcast. My books are doing better. Like we have these measures. But I think when we look back, I think we think when we were younger that we were more of a savage when we were younger. Yeah. And then you want to kind of push that onto your children. But you're waking up at 5 a.m., or at least you were waking up at 5 a.m. and going to the gym on your own merit, like your own, you know, doing it on your own. And I think that's a great way to lead, is just, hey, like this stuff can help make a better life, like your grandmother did. It sounded like she didn't like shove that on you.
That's true.
She's like, this is one way to live. It sounded like when you moved in with your mother, like, I don't know what way of living this is, but I don't want anything to do with this. Yeah. And so I think that's a great example for a lot of parents that listen to the show of like, you don't really have to force stuff. If you just are maybe given good options and presenting like
exposure,
like you don't have to be frustrated and mad. Like we can go on a walk and we can have a conversation. We can talk about how I don't want you out past 11:30 or whatever the situation is. You can have a conversation about it. You can talk about it.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I've seen is that today, more than ever, what happens with our fitness as far as, you know, adults and parents, there tends to be this dichotomy between my fitness and my kids. And so it's just like you have to choose one or the other.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, you know, mom just leaves and she goes to this place called the gym, whatever the fuck that is. And so the kid doesn't really see mom doing the thing, right? And so if we can just invite our children in a little bit more, you know, again, just exposure to seeing mom do the thing. Or like he said, like, I'm just hearing this for the first time when he would come with me to UMSL, to the university I worked at, and he wanted to mess around on the machines and lift the little weights. Like, I didn't even know that, you know? But eventually, like, I could see the influence of the culture that we're creating. And so I wanted to do things with him and in front of him so he can just have this. And we know about this in neuroscience now with mirror neurons, right? So we have mirror neurons that are essentially, these neurons run a simulation of whatever you're witnessing or listening to. So as you guys are watching me talk, these mirror neurons are simulating you're talking, right? And so when we're watching fucking Fast and Furious and watching Vin Diesel do all that shit, there's a part of our brains that are simulating us doing that, you know? Yeah. And then that's why we talk at the end, like, family. Driving fast on the way home from the theater, you know? So if we understand this is happening all the time, because kids don't just, like, you don't just teach a kid to walk. They're watching all the time. Their brain is recording this and all the associated cells. And we know this now as well, like with visualization and seeing people improve their free throw shooting, for example, running through it, comparable to people who are actually doing it. Not to say don't go and get your reps in, but you simulating the thing, your cells, there are certain things that are firing, that neural connection, that are just really remarkable and overlooked. So if we can add that in to create the culture to where these things, and one of the things, like, again, like, he's doing stuff that I ain't even doing. Like, he's getting up at, you know, 5 a.m., 4:30, getting to the gym. But I got him around Eric Thomas, you know, number one motivational speaker in the world. Mm-hmm. That's his thing. He gets up 3 a.m., 4 a.m. in the morning. He's been doing that for years. And so
I love that speech when he talks about how he started waking up at 5, and then he's like 4:30, and then he's like 4 a.m., he's like, and then 3:45.
That's exactly how it happened for me. The gym that I've been going to, the only available space was 6 o'clock in the morning. And then, so I was waking up at 5, going at 6. And then me and my friend were just like, let's go at 5. And it just kind of just happened. And I'm pretty sure, well,
that is a good friend.
I'm not going to push it to like 4 or anything.
He's already pushing it. Well, but anyways.
Andrew has a son that's not even one yet, and he's probably seeing you guys work out, you and your wife, right?
Yeah, every time I get on my, like, equipment and stuff, he, like, you know, he wants to go grab whatever it is. And he's barely started crawling, but he crawled to the cable machine, and he's pulling on the handle. And I'm like, yeah, let's go. So, like, I take off all the weight, and I'm, like, lifting it for him just so he can fall backwards with it. But, and also, today, first day, he said dada. So
yeah!
Fucking, dude, I know. I'm so happy. Yeah. It was amazing.
They never say mama first.
Well, so he's been like crying mama, but then today was like official, like da-da. I'm like, I'll take it.
Let's go.
I know, I'm so proud. But I did want to ask, so like it seems like you let Jordan just kind of do whatever he wanted to do. And I'm only asking this because obviously I want my son to get into lifting, sports and stuff. But if he turns around and looks at me one day and be like, dad, I want to get into ultra marathon running. I'm going to be like, shit, I don't know anything about that. But I'm also going to support him. But did you ever try to influence him to go a certain way? And if he went the other way, like, how did you handle that? Like, did you just kind of be patient? Or, like, I'm just asking for dad advice. Yeah. For when you hit that fork in the road, how do you sit back and just be like, so I guess swallow your pride, like, this ain't it for me right now. I'm going to do what he's going to do. Or, like, what was, like, I guess what happened?
Yeah. So when he says do what he wants to do, there's still that's still under the umbrella of the culture that we have created already, you know? So we are in fact always a product of our environment. We have no choice but to be. But the thing about humans, we're creators of our environment too. So we can create and change things that outpicture and influence us and the people around us. And so within our household and our family dynamic, he's exposed to all these healthy inputs, you know? So it's just like he has such a foundation. But also, so the part of him doing what he wants, I know that he's going to be out here in the world. So I'm not going to police him on if he's, you know, like, we're doing this, you know, super whatever, paleo, keto, whatever, you know, just strict, whatever. And then he's going to a birthday party. Like, I'm not going to, why would I do that? You know, because also I want him to get the input and to see how he feels with having such a healthy template when he does a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Right.
And do you find that that keeps you more on point? Because I'm not, so I grew up, I ate, everything was frozen, right? Frozen burritos, frozen this, frozen that. And now with my son, I'm like, oh, you ain't ever eaten any of that. You know, he's eating steak already. We're Mexican, so of course he's eating tons of beans and rice. And I've noticed that, like, I want less stuff in the house that will, like, influence him also, or, like, right now. Like, I want to eat better. So what is it like knowing that your kids are just way better off than what you had growing up, you know, as far as, like, their diet and nutrition?
I mean, the thing is also we can see it for ourselves. You know, I could see this guy, like, he's got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And also my youngest son, man, he's like a freaking little model, you know, like, and he's so freaking tall. Like, I was in eighth grade, I was one of the tallest kids in my class. Then my body started breaking down. Like, that's when everything started to go downhill. And I'm giving this, the youngest kid, like, he was there with me in Ferguson. Like, he had some deprivation years as well. My youngest son is going to be, he's like literally the tallest kid in his class, you know? Yeah. And so just giving him all of this stuff to give his genes the best shot to be the best expression possible, you know? So I could see it visually. Versus, a lot of folks don't know this shit, because, and this is one of the most messed up things in our reality. Since 1980, the rate of childhood obesity has tripled in the United States. It's tripled. Now, on top of that, with all the shutdowns that took place recently, the CDC published this, by the way. They found that childhood obesity took a massive jump. Children who were chronically obese, their annual weight gain went from about 8 pounds up to almost 15 pounds. Okay?
Damn.
For kids who were moderately obese, they went from an annual weight gain of about around six pounds to almost 12 pounds. It almost doubled. And then for kids who were, quote, normal weight children, which again is starting to, we're almost at a place where it's half and half. Their annual weight gain bumped up a couple of pounds as well. Now, we might say, okay, well, this is a short-term thing. Everybody's had issues. But people don't understand the science around recidivism. And that template that you get, you know this, when you're a kid, and when you're a kid and you venture into being overweight or obese, it becomes exceedingly, seemingly impossible for a lot of folks to lose that weight when they get into adulthood. And so we're starting our kids off in this very disadvantaged position because of the culture that we've created. And again, a lot of parents are not, we're not trying to fuck our kids up. We don't want our kids to struggle and deal with all this stuff, but we're fucked up. You know, how easy is it going to be when I'm experiencing a chronic disease, like the majority of Americans? I'm in a state where my mental health is not good. I'm dealing with all this fear and anxiety of what's going on in the world right now. The list goes on and on. I'm just inundated with all this stuff. How much energy am I going to have to create that culture of health, like I've been talking about? It has an expenditure. But the thing, the beautiful part is when we engage in those things, it starts to feed into itself. Like, you start to have more energy to do all this stuff and you don't even know you're doing it, you know? And so the mission now is to get folks exposed, because a part of the reason people don't do this stuff is they don't know, even know it exists. They don't even know it's possible, you know, much like me. I could easily not be standing here with you guys today, you know, but I got some access. I got exposure to ideas which were there the whole time. But while I was in my mindset of, I can't get better, why won't somebody help me? You know, these are the, there's this amazing thing with the brain. It's called instinctive elaboration. Whenever you ask a question, your brain has to answer it. It's kind of like how TV producers manipulate us, like that open loop, you know, like you have to find the answer to a thing. Anything you pose your mind, especially habitually, it's constantly, you know, your reticular activating system, your reticular cortex, it's parts of your brain that are constantly looking for in the environment to answer your question, to affirm what you're asking. Mm. And so if you're asking habitually, like I was for those 2 years, why me? Why me? Why me? Why won't somebody help me? I'm just looking in my environment and internal environment to affirm why me, why nobody's helping me, and how terrible of a person I am, and how much of a failure I am, and not living up to my potential, and all these things. I'm just feeding into it. As soon as I ask, what can I do to get healthy? everything changed. Literally, the next week, I had known this woman for probably 2 years. She was a chiropractor, you know. I thought it was all super weird. I just did. But I'd known her all this time. And when I asked that and I changed that question, within that week, she took me to Wild Oats, you know, before they got bought up by Whole Foods. And I'm seeing something I never saw before. There was a nutrition prescription book, and they had all these studies on, like, because I looked at bone density. And I was like, what the fuck? I didn't know this. It was there the whole time. I didn't have to go through those 2 years of suffering. The answer was there, but I wasn't attuned to it because of my habitual question.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, what that a lot of times we're kind of shielded from some of that information that is now, because you've been studying it for so long, is like seems so common to us. It's hard to kind of like figure out a way to get into people's households and then have them build a culture like what you have built in your own home. What are some common things in your own home that are cultural things that you think other people could kind of look at and say, hey, that's not that hard to implement. I think we could do some of that.
Yeah. We always want to control the controllables whenever possible. You know, obviously life is going to have a lot of curveballs, a lot of things that are out of your control. One of the easiest things that you can do is, you know, everybody's together to start the day. You know, you're all kind of getting up and getting to your respective places. To start your day, like, give your kids an infusion of some real nutrients, like some things that can actually fuel. Again, they're going to make their brain cells out of these things. I was on the school free lunch program and free breakfast, so I had a little red ticket, and I was fueling myself on Tony the Tiger Frosted Flakes.
Yeah,
that's what I was eating, you know. And so, as well as the rest of the kids there in my school, for my kid, you know, I can give him some, you know, pastured eggs. I can give him, you know, a smoothie with all these superfoods in it. I can give him a good start, a head start. Even if he has a corn dog later, you know, whatever it is, like, this is a good opportunity. Let me start the day by giving him something of high quality. You know what I mean? And so actually, he knows this, his brother, a lot of times I'll just make him, like, I have my, this kind of like super, I call it superhero coffee that I make. And he has this mushroom hot chocolate mix that he has, you know? So it's like reishi mushroom.
Yeah.
And
ooh, how do you make
organic
it?
Cacao. So it's this company, Four Sigmatic.
Okay, right? Yeah, got you. Okay,
dual cool. Extracted uh-huh. Mushroom. Mm-hmm. You know, those are my guys.
Cool.
And so he's intermittent fasting like 4 days a week. You know, because he'll do that. 2 days ago, I came home from the gym. It was like 11 a.m., maybe close to noon, and all he had was that. And I was just like, and I thought maybe his mom had made him something.
Your 10-year-old son.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was just sitting on the couch, you know, I think he was reading something. And I was like, did you eat something? Because I was about to make something. And he was like, no, he's not tripping. Yeah. Like, he's okay, yeah. You know? But so, yeah, so just, but it's a part of the culture. Uh-huh. And it was also like, I make my wife her coffee and me, and then make his little drink. And then boom, you know, this guy's already out at the gym, coming back, making his, you know, 24 eggs or whatever it is. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's just these simple things, especially starting the day. And by the way, this is when he's not going on campus to do something. This is like when he's at home. Like right now, as I mentioned, I was talking to him about the economies of scale and these government subsidies. Because now, because of what's taking place in the world, it's forced me to, we do a mixture of homeschool now. Which I, if we think about this, and if I'm honest with my own heart, this is what I should have been doing in the first place. Because I'm teaching him real shit they can actually use in his life and to serve and help other people.
And people always say, why isn't this taught in school? Well, right. It's probably not supposed to be taught in school. It should be taught in your house.
That's it. That's it. You know? And so one of the biggest issues facing our world today right now, truly, this is one of the, I'd say, three biggest issues is our education system. And all that's taking place in the world is making people to reassess these things, which is very healthy. And now that it's so fluxed up and malleable, it's easier to change, you know, because we've been outsourcing our children's education to people. We don't even know these fucking people, you know, first of all. No disrespect, Miss Blackmore. Thank you. You know, like, I shout out to my good teachers that I've had over the years, but I've had some not good teachers, you know. And also, what are they teaching our children? A big thing, a big foundational tenet within our school system is compliance, you know. And so you have a certain way. This is right and wrong. You do this our way or you fail.
Yeah.
you do this our way, you sit down. You sit down. Their innate drive of a child is to play and to move. And you force in the bad kids. And what do? We medicate them. Like, this whole thing is fucked up. Like, there's no part of it that's okay. And also, what are we teaching them? So many things that have literally zero value to their life and their success. We're not teaching them about practical things as well, you know? And so we're teaching several generations of children how to be workers in jobs that don't exist, in a sense, you know? If they can even piece it together to be trained for those things, you know? And so we're not getting these practical education. And also, that's what changed with me was, instead of me dissecting this worm and the teacher like giving me a fail or a pass, now I understand, like, oh shit, like, part of the reason I have so much more energy now is because there's a change that took place with my mitochondria. I learned about the mitochondria in this class, but it was here today, gone today. Like, I was just trying to get past this test. I didn't get it. Now I'm in love with it. Like, my son is here. He knows all day, every day. I'm talking every day, even when you're sleeping or you're kicking it on Sundays, I still take time off, but I'm researching, you know, and I'm taking this and I'm thinking as I'm going through all of these peer review journals, just in the last year alone, a couple thousand peer review journals I've analyzed. All right. The reps that I have, but here's what I do. As I'm analyzing this, I'm thinking, how can I teach this? How can I make this unnecessarily complex jargon by academics? And I used to do that too. I was writing as if I'm, you know, trying to be, you know, and speaking in that language versus how can you make this make sense for the public who needs this right now? As I talked to you guys earlier about circadian medicine, you know, that's affecting everybody every microsecond of our lives, but most people have no idea about it. They have the right to know. We don't need 20 years before this becomes common knowledge. How can I teach this right now? So that's what I do.
When you were saying, why me? I think the biggest difference with that is, I think a lot of times people think that the things that we can have done to ourselves, I think people think will have the same impact as the things that we can do for ourselves. And they certainly don't. They're way different. Because when you go and explore the things that you can actually go and do for yourself, like go on a walk, go on a jog, lift some weights, start to analyze your diet a little bit, maybe look at your sleep, say my sleep sucks, maybe your job is super stressful, maybe your relationship is super stressful. We start to look inward. That's where you find all the answers. So yeah. A lot of times when somebody is kind of saying, why me? Well, it's you, because you have to look inward to find all the answers.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell this to people who are doing, you know, who are coaches. I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of physicians and nurse practitioners over the years. But anybody who's working with people, especially in health, if you simply ask people the questions and listen to them, they'll tell you the cause and cure of whatever it is that's going on in their life. They already know. It's already within them. But what we tend to do is try to tell people our thing. Like, here's what you need to do. You know, instead of like just ask key questions, dig around, let them tell you because they already know, and just listen.
Can you give us an example? Maybe an example of somebody that you're helping that's maybe just pretty overweight?
Yeah. So let me think of a specific person I could tell you about. Okay. So this amazing woman comes in. She's a very successful lawyer, very prominent in our city, and she's not happy with how she looks, you know. She's stressed. She doesn't really feel capable. She kind of identifies herself as an athlete because, you know, what she did in high school, even though it's like, you know, 20, 30 years later. And she's kind of lost herself in that aspect. She still has a sense of empowerment about her. And so, you know, one of the first things I do is just, you know, of course, just ask people the surface thing, which is, you know, what your goals are. And a lot of times people don't even know that, or they give you something very superficial. Or a lot of times people in my office, they would just like pull their shirt up and grab their, like, I just want to get rid of this. Like, if I could keep, I like my butt and my legs, but just they grab their belly and shake it at me. And I guess maybe people felt comfortable to do that. I'm just thinking of how many times that happened. But you know, so they just want to get this weight off. But why is it there? Like, what are the things, the underlying mechanisms that put you in this position? We got to get there, you know, because I could tell you what to do, but if you still have this identity and these behavior patterns that got you in this place, we're never going to get there. And so, you know, I start digging and I ask, okay, so for example, if you achieve this goal, you know, if we're able to, you know, get 4 inches off your waist in the next 2 months, what would that mean to you? Like, what are you going to, what is going to be different about your life? Mm-hmm. You know? And so she's like, I feel better in my clothes. I would have more confidence. And I'm starting to dig around here and starting to hear she's leaning into like, you know, I want to look good for my husband, you know? And also, you know, she has kids and she wants to be an example for them. Right. And so she's starting to share these things, but there's like specklings of it. And so eventually I get these things out. That what she really wants, she wants to feel confident again. She wants to use this confidence. She sees herself, if she can just feel good about herself, she's going to perform better as a lawyer as well. So I find another leverage point. So performing better as a lawyer, her major identity, lawyer, family, right? And so we started to lean into these things. And her daughter was going to be, she was dating a guy. She's going to be getting married. Right. And so I'm just like, okay, I can use this as well. You know, she's going to be there, the dress, all that stuff, and wanting to be an example of what a couple can be. Right. Because she felt like she showed her daughter that she can lose herself, lose touch with her health over the years. Mm. You know, so she wanted to show that you can have it all and be healthy. Right. So that's the thing for her was were those things. She believed that she had to sacrifice her health in order to be successful, right? And so the solution was making it a part of her life, making it herself a priority, which she had never done before. She made her work a priority, right? And so what I focused on with her, which is what you guys do, was getting her stronger because she was carrying a lot. And man, so once she started pulling stuff off the ground, you know, just getting physically stronger, she lost some inches off her waist. She became so much more powerful, like a powerful presence was unlocked, you know? And so she just felt more, even she told me like, Sean, I carried all the groceries in one trip, you know, like shit like that, like was so impressive to her, you know? So I hope I answered the question. I might've gotten off track a little bit there, but you know, it's just finding that thing within somebody's psychology and leveraging that, you know, because she knew what it was. It was her putting herself last, her physical health last. And she was able to share that because she was trying to be successful and pave a way for her children who are now getting to be older. And she feels like she had kind of lost herself.
Well, that kind of stuff is great because I think that, you know, like maybe in this person's life or maybe just as other examples, maybe in the case of the husband, maybe the husband, you know, has some other people at work that are really good looking and now the wife's like, like I should probably step my shit up. You know, there's things like that happen. And when you start talking to people and you start to kind of get to the root of the problem, I have found you go a couple questions deep and a lot of times somebody starts to cry.
Yep.
And they're like, you know, my dad told me this when I was a kid and I've always kind of doubted my, and you're like, oh my God, this is just crushing. But we can get somebody out of this situation simply by what you're talking about with correct foods.
You know what's so crazy is that, and I just remember this, again, the road to get to being, listen, being healthy is actually ridiculously simple. You know, just eat real stuff, move your body some, sleep. That's pretty much it. Yeah. Like, this is not difficult. Well, I mean, let me not say that. This is not complex necessarily. Mm-hmm. Now, what people would usually do in my office is that when they get the awareness of what needs to be done, they understand their body. Now the practicality of getting there, they start blaming. Well, I could, but my husband. I could, but my kids. Kids got the most hatred in my office as far as like the parents blaming them for all their stuff. Like, your mom, well, I mean, I understand, but my kids just won't eat it, you know. And we're talking about you. Like, people already start with the, you know, the finger pointing and blame because of their personal responsibility as well. So we got to find a way to engage that that sense of sovereignty and responsibility as well. Because in our culture, we've outsourced so much of this stuff to other people. And, you know, just an example of like how psychologically we can gain weight as a protection mechanism. My mother, when I was probably 7 years old, she worked overnight at a 7-Eleven type place. It was called Magic Market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is just what, again, trying to, when I would go to her, I lived in my grandma's house still, but I'd go to her house on the weekends and I slept on the floor. You know, me and my little brother on a little pallet. It's roaches and, you know, mice traps by us and all this stuff. And, but anyway, so she would go to this job overnight. My stepfather worked during the day. She got stabbed 8 times by somebody trying to rob her. And, but she ended up, my mom is, man, like she's fucking, my son knows. Man. She's like Wolverine, man. Like she actually, pinned him down and held him until the police came, right? And so when she goes into the hospital to get all these stitches for these stab wounds, okay, she got stabbed 8 times. And the doctor told her, your weight saved your life. If you were not heavy set like you are, you would have died. Her being fat saved her life. What do you think she's going to do now? Do you think she's ever going to lose this weight? It's protecting her. It's saving her life, right? And so from there, like that was, she was always just kind of, you know, a bit bigger. But from that moment on, it just went really downhill, you know? And so what are the things we tie up psychologically? And this is real, you know, a lot of people, we have these defense mechanisms, you know, and how we do things with our bodies, how we hide, how we protect ourselves. And so that's other work that needs to be done for a lot of folks too. You know, it's like getting to the core of like one of the best examples, Katie Wellness Mama. I don't know if you know Katie. She's got a massive brand for like, you know, natural skincare and natural cures for things and like, you know, big mommy bloggers type stuff. And she's got 6 kids, by the way, too. They're all homeschool. I went to her house in Florida. I couldn't believe it. Like there was like a 3-year-old like flying a drone and shit. Like it was crazy. Like doing all the Rubik's cubes in like 5 seconds. If I didn't see this, I wouldn't think it was possible. Like I think the kid was 3 years old, but using a straight up steak knife and just like cutting their steak. I'm just like doing their own laundry, all of this stuff. And I'm just looking at because I think my son Braden was maybe 5 at the time. I'm just like, you're fucking up. Like, you got to get to work. And since then, like, he's been doing his own laundry. But but she had invested so much in her kids' sustainability of the household so that they're self-sufficient. And she had constantly been struggling with her weight all this time, though. And she shared with me, because now, it's taken her years to figure it out. It's something that she didn't expect, which was dealing with her psychology and something that happened during her childhood, that she felt safe and protected. She felt that she wouldn't be, in a sense, like wanted or aggressed if she was carrying this weight. And when she realized this, and she broke down, and she's a very even keel human being. And, you know, I'm just sharing what's already out there on my show. But all she did was she healed her psychology. And again, your thoughts are creating chemistry in your body. Every single thought all the time. Now, that doesn't mean that she isn't doing sprints. Like she started doing stuff she had never done before. The weight started coming off, but each step along the way, she leaned into it. She started doing pole vault and she was heavy, heavy, right? And so she started getting some of this weight off, started pole vaulting. There she is. Yeah. Yeah.
Shit.
Incredible.
Drastic.
Incredible, you know? And so for her, also doing things that she wouldn't have thought to do, like eating a lot of protein. For example, you know, like each step along the way supported the process, but the triggering event was her dealing with her psychology and her feeling that, you know, she needed her weight as a protection.
Power Project Familia, how is it going? Now, working with a lot of different clients and also talking to so many different coaches that have come onto this show, I've seen that and I understand that people have cravings. We all have cravings. And the crazy thing and the rough thing is that when you're dieting, you can't just eat as many donuts or eat all the cereal you want to eat. But that's why we have good, healthy treats. And our new sponsor, Magic Spoon, has amazing cereal. Now, number one,
A lot of cereals have a lot of carbohydrates and a lot of sugar. Let me tell you the macros on this. 0 grams of sugar, 4 grams of net carbs, 14 grams of protein per serving, and 140 calories per serving. Let's not neglect the fact that even though these macros might be good, a lot of times these healthy snacks taste like cardboard and crap. But when you eat Magic Spoon, when you take your first bite, you're going to be reminded of the childhood cereal that you used to eat. I'm serious,
yes,
bro.
Yes, no,
when I had
know.
That peanut butter, man, I was like, oh my God, is this Reese's Pieces? Like, I was like, damn, man, it's good.
Yeah.
So you guys need to check them out. Andrew, how can people learn more about
Absolutely.
It?
And there's one more thing I wanted to add. So like my wife, she has a gluten intolerance. I believe she has celiac disease. So cereal in general is just sometimes it's hard to find. Most cereals are gluten-free, but like all the fun ones aren't. So another amazing thing about Magic Spoon is it is gluten-free. So if you do have a sensitive stomach, you have no issues here. So head over to magicspoon.com/powerproject. You guys will see the variety pack. That's really the best way to kind of dip your foot into this bowl of cereal, because you're going to be able to try different flavors and figure out which one you like the most. So again, that's at magicspoon.com/powerproject. You'll receive $5 off that variety pack. Links to them down in the description, as well as the podcast show notes. Head over there right now.
You know, I'm curious, how do you approach change, like changing people's psychology and belief? Because you know who Joe Dispenza is?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious what you think of some of his stuff, because some people read his stuff and they're like, oh, this is too out there, too woo woo. Yeah. But I mean, the power of the subconscious is a really weird thing. Like, I'm a big believer of, like, you know, the things that you're inputting on your social media feed, the things that you're watching or whatever, that's going to have a, it's going to affect the way you think and believe things. Yeah. So how do you handle that? How do you, like, how did you teach that to your kids to pay attention to that? Just how do you go about that?
One of Joe's books is, I believe the title is You Are the Placebo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? And so it's just digging into the some of the science that, you know, again, I've been studying and teaching for many years as well. And Joe, I've had a great conversation with Joe. It's one of the most popular episodes of my show.
Okay.
But the thing I really like about Joe is that he continuously does find places to integrate logic and science, you know, and, but also he is leaning into things that are beyond our scientific description. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It doesn't mean that they're not real. He had a similar story to mine, like his saying, you know, you're never going to walk again. He was in a tragic accident.
Yeah.
And he was able to heal and come back from something that was supposed to be impossible. Same thing with me. If I'm coming back from something you say is impossible and I do that thing, I have a certain level of power and understanding that you can't buy that, you know? And so somebody like, I'll give you a good example. When I was living in Ferguson, when my mother-in-law gave me a film that he was in, that's kind of started his initial pop, like super popularity, it's called What the Bleep Do We Know? Mm-hmm. All right. It was about all this like quantum physics. And when I first watched it, and this was probably, I don't know when it came out, but maybe I'm just going to say 15 years ago, I fell asleep on it. Mm-hmm. And my son knows I don't fall asleep on stuff. Like, I don't. But it was just so like, what is this shit? I just like completely dismissed it. Cut to a year later. At this point, my mother-in-law has been teaching meditation for like 40 years or something. Okay. Bananas. But now, you know, she taught me meditation. Now I'm like really understanding that I have agency over the way that I think. Prior to that, I was just existing, you know, like I wasn't aware that I was aware. I wasn't aware that these thoughts, like I can see the thoughts now, like, and I can disassociate and I can change them, right? I start to develop all of this power and this beauty that was already existing in me. So now I'm learning meditation. I see What the Bleep Do We Know 6 months later. I'm just like, my jaw's on the floor. Like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, like this is how it all works. Like, this is how reality works, you know? And so what they were talking about, for example, was, I'll give you guys an example. Have you ever heard of the phantom DNA experiment?
No.
I have not. No.
Okay. So some Russian scientists, and people can look this up. It's called the phantom DNA experiment. They used a vacuum, right? So not like a floor cleaning vacuum, but like a vacuum chamber. Okay. Where there's nothing else in there. Everything is pulled out of this, right? And so, but they know still within this study, within the vacuum, there are going to be packets of light that all of reality is made of, these biophotons. There's nothing you can do about that, right? But other than that, there's nothing else in this chamber. And so what they did was they put in a strand of human DNA mm-hmm. into the vacuum and sealed it. And something really interesting happened. The biophotons that were just randomly scattered throughout the vacuum chamber began to conform to the human DNA. They all became attracted and conformed literally to the shape of the human DNA. Mm-hmm. So something about human DNA affected the stuff that the reality is made of. All right. Our reality is made of these biophotons. And so just the human DNA just being present changed the reality, how things were conformed. Now, they thought that when they take the DNA out, of course, the biophotons are going to go back to their scattered formation. But what happened was when they removed the human DNA, the biophotons still stayed conformed as if the human DNA was still there. So it made at least a temporary imprint on reality just with the presence of human DNA. Now, if you scale that out a little bit and you understand that we are literally affecting the environment around us, period. I'm just giving one example of how we're doing this. You know, there's string theory. Research, the U.S. military is like the goats of having all this data and not sharing this shit, mm-hmm. but like doing experiments where people are in different states and having, you know, stimulation, which, you know, they're probably electrocuting them, things of that, of the like, and another person being able to pick up that and changing their heart rate or changing their, you know, using an EEG or, magnetoencephalograph and these different things to monitor what their physiological response is based on something happening to somebody else. But another really cool experiment was researchers at Yale University. They had people just come together, and it's already happened for us since we've been here. Mm-hmm. What happened was they just had two people, didn't know each other, just create rapport for a few minutes. Then they separately, you know, analyzed their brainwave activity, and they saw that their brainwaves began to sync up just by them being in conversation mm-hmm. with each other. So literally it's like a dance that takes place. We can't see it happening, but our brains start to sync up, right? So we're affecting other people as well. So we're affecting the environment. We're affecting other people. And so these are all things that Joe has been teaching for a long time. And so again, how do we practically apply this? We have to understand how powerful we are. Right now, even people who are about that life and trained, they're falling victim to all this negativity that's taking place. And it's influencing them deeply. And I'll be honest, it's happened to me a couple of times, but I have the tools to get out of it, you know, because we care. And also, if idiocy is taking place and the world is just completely gone bonkers, like, it's going to bother you. But I realized, again, I'm not just at the effect of the environment. I'm creator of the environment. And also, I can be a light. I can be something that changes the environment when I come into it versus me being at the mercy of it. You know, so it's having that practical tool and that knowledge that no matter what's going on in the world, bring it to it. You bring the energy to it. And we all need our cup filled. So surround yourself with people who are able to give you. And the cool thing about today is that you don't have to be in the room face to face with the person, but just immersing yourself in people who remind you of how powerful you are, you know, and making that a daily practice as well.
There's other research, too, like where people just will write something down. They'll write down their goal. And there's, you know, there's people that just because they simply took the time to write down their goal, they are more likely to be successful. Not always do they hit that exact goal, but just the intention of having a goal, setting a goal, having the courage to write it down. Because a lot of times the goals can be a little challenging. They can be a little scary. Yeah. Where you're like, oh, I don't know if I'll be able to make that, but I'm going to write it down anyway.
Yeah. The best way to not achieve your goal is to not have any. You know, right. And that research is Dr. Gail Matthews. I actually talked about her in Eat Smarter in my latest book. So we got all this cutting edge, amazing nutrition science. The first part of the book is dedicated to nutrition and metabolism. The second part is dedicated to nutrition and cognitive performance, emotional intelligence as well, how our nutrition affects our ability to have empathy and the ability to have patience, these kind of like soft skills. And then also there's a chapter in there. I had to talk about it. Is good sleep nutrients and how your nutrition affects your sleep. But the last part of the book is really dedicated to the psychology of all this stuff. You just learned all this cool shit. Now what? Like, what can we actually do about this mm-hmm. in practical ways? And one of those is the science around goal setting. It's one thing to have a goal, and it's great. Again, like, that's the first step. But writing the goal down, the research indicated it was like a 30% increase in folks achieving the goal, 30 to 40% increase, simply by writing it down. It like unlocks some kind of, and again, the researchers are looking at, they're doing a randomized trial. And just having these folks, if they just write it down, they achieved more than the people who didn't write it down because the thing's just rattling around in their head. Mm. And of course, I'm just always like, why? Like, why? I think a practical piece of that is it takes courage to write it down. It takes courage to say, I want this. You know, so you're actually taking an action step by declaring like, I want this 50-pound weight loss, or I want this car, you know, and actually writing it down. And it's also creating a physical thing in the world as well. Like, as you're spelling it out, it's like casting a spell in a sense. You know what I mean? Like you're creating something physical out of your thought. Like, this is what I want. So you're making it's kind of like a declaration to life. Like, I'm serious about this, you know? So yeah, just that. And also another thing they found in the study, they had even more success, higher rate of goal achievement when people had accountability, you know? So this doesn't mean that you tell everybody your goals,
right?
But just having somebody that you can share this with who holds you accountable, you know, who just like can check in with and like, hey, how's it going on such and such? When we have community and support, it does tend to help.
Why did you step forward more recently and talk about stuff that would be considered to be controversial? It doesn't seem like there's a reason on why you would do that when you already have successful books. You already have a very successful podcast. And with some of the stuff that you've been talking about, you can be like deplatformed. You can be censored a lot. Like, what's the burning reason on why you feel that you have to be one of the people to step forward and talk?
You know, Mark, I mean, to be 100 with you, this, it doesn't even seem like I'm doing anything different. It's what I've been doing since the beginning. The difference is, things are so much more polarizing now and inflammatory, and basic logic is being abandoned in many senses. Like, part of my work over the years is educating people on social structures that have led to, here, listen, just so everybody's clear on this, the United States is the fattest nation in history, in the history of humanity.
Like, yeah, we're fattest and
most chronically diseased.
Most chronically diseased, also most dependent on pharmaceuticals. I mean, the list
taking the most drugs,
most anxiety, most depression. I mean, it's just, the list goes
it's
on and on.
Crazy because we have the most freedom too and the most ability to do what we want.
Yeah. The most access. And
some of that paradox causes those things.
Yeah. So there's this paradox taking place where, with all of our advancements in technology, in science, you would think our lifespan would continue to rise. But right now, we've reached a point just recently, a couple years ago, where it's reversed, where we're the first generation now that is not going to outlive our predecessors. It's going backwards now. But prior to that even happening, people were not necessarily living longer. They were dying longer. We found ways to just keep people with their low quality of life, just keep them kind of trucking along. And so, number one, that there's that. Something is fucking off. Like, that doesn't make sense. As advanced and evolved as we're supposed to be, is this happening? We're knocking on the door right now of 250 million United States citizens being overweight or obese. 250 million. It doesn't even make any fucking sense. 130 million U.S. citizens are diabetic, type 2 diabetic right now, or pre-diabetic. It's a beyond epidemic proportions. 115 million Americans are regularly sleep deprived. 60% of Americans have some degree of heart disease. 50 million Americans, upwards of 50 million, have an autoimmune condition now. That shit used to be rare. All of these things were rare. And now it's absolutely invaded our society. And the thing is, here's one of the biggest reasons why I'm doing anything about this and speaking about it, is that when we're in this state of poor health, it becomes, it's not that it's impossible, but it becomes substantially harder to have compassion. It becomes substantially harder to utilize your higher order faculties, executive function, analyzing simple principles of, you know, right and wrong and context and nuance and perspective taking. It's not that it's impossible when you're not doing well, but it's harder just because there's a lot of physiological energy being siphoned that pulls away from the function of your brain, period. And so we have a nation of people who are very sick fighting each other, and now in a state where they're depending on people who have, in many ways, helped them to be in this position of sickness, and they're putting their trust in them. So for years, the walls were kind of coming down in understanding pharmaceutical companies, big food manufacturers, our government's investment in disease. And now suddenly, for many people, all of that progress that we're making, bringing these things to light, just stopped. Like, it's cool. Pfizer's got my back. Not understanding, literally, just today, the guy emailed me who was there involved in the litigation with Pfizer. Is this Harvard professor. He's brilliant. But he got to see. He still, it's a non-NDA. He can't talk about it. But he was on that the panel, this legal team. Pfizer was ordered to pay the largest healthcare fraud settlement in the history of the United States Department of Justice. All right?
For what?
That's the thing, right? That's a thing. That's a fact, what I just shared. But the details, these motherfuckers are so powerful, they don't even have to tell you what they did. Do you understand how fucked up this is? Okay? So Pfizer, and this is what they got caught doing, all right? Not to say that they cannot create something that could be helpful to society. But when we put our faith in these organizations as if they're looking out for us, not only that, Pfizer was also caught testing experimental drugs on children in Nigeria. Listen, my guys over there, go to Dr. Google, look it up. Pfizer, Nigerian children, lawsuit. So they were ordered to pay $2 billion for the Department of Justice issue. But that's scraps to them, man.
That was in 96?
We lean so heavily on the pharmaceutical companies. It's like, it's embarrassing. What? You know, I heard our president just like yesterday. I don't remember every detail of what he said, but basically he talked about insulin being more available and, you know, lowering the cost of it and it being less expensive. And I was like, well, that's great, because there's a lot of people that are suffering. There's a lot of people that are diabetic. But, you know, along with the money that you're going to allocate to that, can we talk about nutrition?
Yeah.
So that the people don't even, it's like, hey, we're going to support you because you're already sick. That sounds fine with me and probably fine with many others. I don't know. Some may disagree with it. But along the way, we're going to also talk about nutrition and maybe start to employ some nutritional intervention, yeah. Try to push you towards certain foods.
That doesn't make money. That doesn't make money, Mark. This is the thing. We have a system. We have a system of healthcare that profits from sickness mightily. We have a $4 trillion healthcare system in the United States. Annually, $4 trillion. There's a new report.
That just doesn't even.
It doesn't even make sense.
It's just like such a high amount. I don't know. My brain can't wrap around it.
Exactly. There's a new report. People can look this up as well. $1 trillion of those dollars is effectively wasted, by the way. Like administrative complexity, like stuff getting lost, fraud. $1 trillion fucking dollars. And again, we're talking about what you're talking about is this. It's under this guise of what we want to do is we want to give access. We want to give access to healthcare. What kind of healthcare are you getting? I had access to crack. It doesn't mean that I need that shit, you know? And so it's access to things that are real and sustainable. Now, the reason I brought up the pharmaceutical angle first is that that's the system we have. It's pharmacology. So when I went to school, that's what I was immediately seeing in the upperclassmen. Pharmacology. They were just teaching, if you have this symptom, this is the drug, right? Not understanding that our physicians are largely, their training, their education is involved or surrounding pharmaceutical companies' influence. And also a lot of their data, for example, the new drugs that have hit the market, they were given emergency use authorization, because they had a randomized placebo controlled trial demonstrating some efficacy. Here's what happened. After they got approval for the emergency use authorization, Moderna, Pfizer, they called up the people who were in the placebo group who didn't get it, and they said, hey, do you want to get it? They unblinded them. About 98% of the folks then got the new drug. They unblinded them. They used a blinded trial, placebo trial, to get approval. So now we don't know, again, 5 years from now, if we had both groups and we can see, was there an increased incidence of myocarditis? Was there an increased incidence of cancer? We just don't have this data now. It's so steered towards favor for the pharmaceutical company. And that's what it's geared towards. Now, let me give you the ultimate answer. So I don't want to get too much into that. Again, it's not to say that pharmaceuticals don't have their place. It's that it's become the number one place. The biggest issue, the CDC reported this, in July is when they published the study. They analyzed the data from over 800 U.S. hospitals and over 540,000 COVID patients. They determined what we already knew, obesity was the number one risk factor for death. Number one risk factor for dying from this thing that's taken over our lives. Why aren't we doing a fucking thing about it? And I said this literally at the very beginning of all this happening. I was literally just watching, you know, he knows this. I'm watching a press conference. It was dubbed the Italian health minister. And he was like, you know, about 88% of folks that are having these poor outcomes have chronic diseases. And I'm just like, okay, this is what we've been training for. Let's get our citizens healthier. We see that this is the biggest susceptibility is being sick. Let's get folks healthier. At least like do some of that. But what happened was none of it, none of it. And even people who I thought were really about that life, who built their brands around like manipulate, no, I'm not going to say that. Encouraging folks to get their programs and courses based on health and real practices of like gut health and all this stuff. They abandoned that stuff. And they were saying things like, Sean, you're right. We do need to get people healthier because it is the number one susceptibility, but we can't get people healthier overnight. Cut to, I just start throwing out peer-reviewed studies on how you can literally improve your health in a fucking day. Appalachian State University, going for a 30-minute walk. Immediately boosts your immune parameters. Natural killer cells, neutrophils, like, it is a temporary boost, but it happens just by going for a walk.
Yeah, one bad night of sleep can mess up the way that you regulate your glucose and things like that, right?
Just like you can improve your health. And I'm not talking about sustainable, like it's a miracle if you go for a walk, but that consistency. But also you can absolutely demolish your health in a day, you know? And we all know this. And so, but that was the thing people were propping up to start to, because of their fear and just going with this bandwagon of, okay, we're just going to fuck everything else, pharmaceuticals. We're going to try and treat our way out of this situation like we always do and just look where we are. So for me, I'm just like, I'm a logical person. Has any of this shit worked? Because we're pretty fucked up. But we kind of abandoned that and we just started to buy into all of these different narratives. So this is my point. So they found that number one, obesity is the leading risk factor for death from SARS-CoV-2. The second leading risk factor for death was anxiety and fear-related disorders.
Oh my God.
The second leading cause of death from?
Risk factor for death.
Risk factor for death from COVID.
Anxiety and fear-related disorders. And I just can't make this shit up. The first person that I called when all of this happened was Dr. Bruce Lipton, who's a cell biologist. He's a pioneer. He's a person, if people have heard the term epigenetics, it's largely because of him. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know, like, what's happening with all of this being inundated with fear 24/7 with a death toll ticker on the television of like all these human lives have been relegated to numbers on the screen. What is this doing to people's physiology? And so he shared with me and for everybody who's listening, the biology of fear, like what that does to your immune system, your cells. And so I did this early 2020. All right. Again, I could see it coming. And then what happened? The second leading risk factor for death was anxiety and fear-related disorders. And it's as if, again, this data is, if you post something about this shit, it's going to like tag the CDC. Nobody's going to the CDC to actually look at this shit, except me. You know, of course, there's some other people, but you know what I mean? It's just like, I'm using it's their words. And as you mentioned, like you can get deplatformed and we got to find creative ways. Like some people are not even going to see this on all platforms because we're talking about it. Unfortunately, and that's not science. What I'm sharing, this is factual data. I don't want it to be that way. I wish it wasn't. I wish like Pfizer was like my boo. I wish Pfizer was amazing. And like, you know, we make sweet love. I don't know, man. Like Pfizer, I have no problem with them being, if they were working in efficacy and really looking out for people. They're making so much money. And last part here, I got to share this. The thing, again, I'm trying to find different leverage points with people's psychology to understand how ineffective and corrupt this is, the system. Pfizer's, on the Pfizer board of directors, is the former commissioner of the FDA. All right. He left the FDA to join Pfizer right before the pandemic happened. That is not okay. Do you think he doesn't have insider information on how this stuff works, approvals and manipulation, all these different things? One of the biggest issues in our system is the revolving doors of pharmaceutical companies, employees, and FDA employees intermingling. It's a very, very twisted system because the FDA is supposed to be our watchdog looking out for these things. A lot of people don't realize this, though. The FDA doesn't do shit as far as like actually testing and analyzing drugs. They just take what the drug companies give them. Here's what we did. Here's the study that we did. You guys check it out. It's like grade your own homework, right? And so this is, but again, for me, it's cool if the results were cool. The results are not cool. EJS Center for Ethics at Harvard University, about 200,000 Americans die every year from pharmaceutical drugs, all right? That's one of the leading risk factors for death in the United States. That's in the top five from taking drugs that are approved by the FDA. And most people have no idea about this, you know? Something is off here. One of the things that's been approved recently, obviously, these opioids and just different versions of them have killed about a million fucking people since 2000. It's not okay. And they're still on the market. Like, it's still making money. Johnson & Johnson was ordered to pay part of a $26 billion settlement for their contribution. Johnson & Johnson is the world's leading grower of the narcotics used to make these opioids. They're El Chapo. Like, it's crazy. But do you think that matters to them? Like, they're paying a little bit of this $26 billion. Do you know how much money they're making right now? It's insane. And so, you know, the last piece again, the FDA portion, with people wondering, like, how's this stuff getting approved and, like, what's going on, even with really damaging things taking place. Again, a lot of people are okay, we think, you know, as of now, and that's good. Like, and we can get some therapeutic benefit. But also, Dr. Jessica Rose, viral immunologist, she's really stepped to the forefront to be a VAERS analyst, looking at the vaccine adverse events, reactions, database. The adverse events for these COVID-related therapeutics, they're literally, this is the fact, 1,100 times more adverse reactions and events reported to VAERS in 2020 than every single vaccine combined for the past 10 years annually. All right, I hope that makes sense. So every vaccine taken combined in 2018, 2020's COVID-related vaccines just alone have over 1,000% more adverse reactions. That's not okay. We just got to, like, if we can look at it, be like, okay, well, what can we do to fix it? We can use vaccine technology to make a bridge here, but we can't do it right if we're not paying attention to the data, to the dark side. And the problem is, if you talk about that, it gets censored. So many people's voices, people have been injured. They just shared their story and then they get deplatformed. There's no part of that that's okay. And last part, this is the last part. With the FDA, that piece. So I mentioned the FDA, that revolving door with employees, but also the FDA. A lot of folks don't realize this. Fucking Pfizer owns them. Pharmaceutical companies provide billions of dollars in funding to the FDA every year. They provide 75% of their scientific review budget, billions of dollars, and almost half their budget. The FDA is supposed to be policing these motherfuckers, and they're literally paying their bills. How, I mean, like, I don't have to make this up.
Damn.
There's nothing okay about that structure. And it was because of the advent of something called user fees. This was in the 90s when this change took place. And again, it's cool if it worked. But what took place since then? The release of some of the most deadly drugs. What happened? The drug approvals skyrocketed and drug rejections plummeted. They just started approving more shit. What do you think is going to happen? You know? And so... I said this already, but so here is the last piece of the FDA.
Just keep going.
All right. So this is the most fucked up part about this. Well, no, I can't say one thing is most fucked up part, but the review board process, the FDA has a panel of physician advisors to review drug companies' data and approve or reject a drug, right? Cool. This was published in the journal Science, one of the most prestigious journals in the United States. It did a massive analysis and found that, again, this is supposed to be physician review board, FDA employees, not having a relationship with these drug companies, and definitely not receiving money from them. They found that almost 40% of FDA physician approval, people on the approval board, almost 40% of them received money from pharmaceutical companies after the approval process, post hoc. So this could be a year later. This could be 9 months later. Some of these approval members, these physicians on the FDA approval board, over $1 million, six figures, tens of thousands, grants, all this stuff. But it's perfectly legal. And as a matter of fact, it's easily, you can go and look it up because of this loophole to where it's like, oh, they're not paying them for approval in the beginning, right? But they give them money later. And so it's perfectly legal. So our drug process is so corrupted. The science even of itself, again, if you look into work by, you know, the one of his newest books is called Sickening. This Harvard professor that, again, we're just messaging with him. You understand that even the drug trials themselves are consistently, like he found the majority of the time, they're not the data that is actually shared with the FDA, with physicians, with the public.
Like they're holding back data? Like you
yes.
Can't.
They're coloring things in a way that make them look favorable. This is why so many people die. So many people get sick. So I mentioned 200,000 people die. I'm not mentioning the millions of people who are hospitalized and injured every year. So, yeah. So again, during this time when we're suddenly relying on these people like they're the holy grail and they have our best interests at heart, I can't just stand back and just be like, oh, yeah, that's totally fine. It's not okay. And also with the politicians, the same thing. You know, these guys, man, come on. Like 2/3 of the United States Congress in 2020 received money from pharmaceutical companies. My guys over there, you could look all of this shit up. 2/3 of our Congress. Our government is so controlled by pharmaceutical companies, it is not okay. There's something twisted about that. Like, what the fuck are we doing? And again, I would be cool if it was working. We're the most medicated society in history, but we are by far the sickest. And yet they are profiting so much off of our sickness. So yeah, they're not going to tell people. They're not going to get on, you know, the breaking news. Go take a walk, you know. Go, you know, watch Mark's videos
do some squats.
And yeah, that doesn't make money, you know. And unfortunately, again, I was disheartened in the beginning because I'm like, okay, this is our time. And I just saw so many people opting out. And I even heard people with big platforms, you know, just like, I'm just going to stay in my lane. Motherfucker, if your lane is health, this is your Super Bowl. Like, this is a time we're writing the history for our children. And just looking what's happening with our fucking children. They're getting the worst of this, you know? And the thing is, these people are not trying to hurt their kids, but they're not well. How the fuck are they going to help their kid? You know, so.
Well, especially with the message that's out there, makes it confusing. You know, like they try to make it seem like you're more of an American citizen if you go and get this shot.
Yeah.
And you don't care about other people. Unless you go and get the shot.
It's the framing, of course. And so even with that, you know, just, this is just logic. This is just basic science. You know, there have been a variety of based on the data, apparently, again, effective inoculations that we've come up with. We've never had anything happen this quickly. And the thing about it is we can make something very fast, but human biology takes time. It just does. Like, we don't know the long-term ramifications.
What do you mean by we haven't had anything happen this quickly?
So we haven't had anything developed this quickly.
Oh, we're talking about the vaccine.
Yeah, right? We're talking about months. The technology to make it, the mRNA technology existed,
right?
But not anything coded for this particular thing and not actually being able to run through the most rigorous trials possible because this is going to be given to our children. Like, you know, it's so strange to me that suddenly we abandon even that basic logic, but also the framing of, you know, you're doing this for others. That is, we all want to do stuff to be a hero. Like, we all do. We want to be somebody who's looking out. But the truth is, it's easy to put on a mask and say, I'm doing it for somebody else. It's more difficult to go and knock on your neighbor's door and say, hey, let's go for a walk. Or, hey, let me get you some groceries. it's more difficult to, like my son here, to get up and go to the gym with his friend in the morning. That's work. That's really doing something for somebody else. Having this superficial thing, this overnight, you're an overnight health advocate because you got a vaccine and you're helping society, or you're putting on a mask and you're helping society. That's such a low tier of humanity, and it's such a low tier of service, and actually being a hero and doing something proactively to actually help somebody to be healthier. Because the truth is, and again, like, fuck, I don't want it to be the case, but when all of this came out, when the peer reviewed evidence came out, what I did was I reached out to the person who actually did a peer reviewed study analyzing the data based on their own, because there's so much data from the mRNA trials. It was massive. Like, it was a lot for me to go through. And so Dr. Ron Brown, he's up in Canada, like, dealing with all this shit, but he did an analysis as a published paper, and it's looking at the miscommunication of the effectiveness of the mRNA vaccine trials. And so what people are hearing about, it has a 99.5% effectiveness, you know, like, and all these different things, these numbers that were getting thrown out there. But what we're talking about is a relative risk reduction, right? So Pfizer had, I believe, a 95% relative risk reduction. So you can look up Dr. Ron Brown mRNA trial. So, yep, there it is. Outcome reporting bias in COVID-19 mRNA vaccine clinical trials. Your boy, what I do, I'll reach out, talk to the professor, because they know me, you know? I'm out here on the streets, you know? So it's like all of these guys are like just my colleagues. And so what he shared was, again, the mRNA trial for Pfizer, 95% effective. Moderna, 94% effective. That sounds amazing. Like, I was just like, shit, like, wow, they really pulled this off. Ron Brown analyzed the data, epidemiologist. And what that number is called the relative risk reduction, all right? That's something that's used more of a kind of a clinical thing. Like, we could test one trial against another trial. It does have some practical application, but that's not your risk reduction as an individual in the real world. That's called the absolute risk reduction. The absolute risk reduction for Pfizer in their own trials was not 95%. It wasn't even fucking 5%. It was a 0.7% absolute risk reduction.
What?
It's right there, man. It's right there on the screen.
Wait, so
less than 1% absolute risk reduction for you as an individual in the real world
to get COVID.
So now this is where it can get a little bit confusing as well. Yeah. The risk reduction from what? What was the risk reduction from? From death? Because even a 1% risk reduction from death, hey, that's something. No, that wasn't demonstrated in the trials. And that's what's so sad that this isn't being talked about. What was demonstrated in their trials was a risk reduction from mild symptoms. There
like
wasn't
a cough.
There wasn't proof of significant risk reduction in death and severe symptoms in their initial trials to get these drugs approved. If it was different, I'd be fine with that, but that's not the case. And for Moderna, it was a 1.1% absolute risk reduction. Okay? So that is your risk reduction as a person in the real world. Now, even still, you could be like, well, 1%, 1.1%, I'll take it. Fuck. Vitamin D. Mm-hmm. We've got about 30 peer-reviewed trials now demonstrating you can get more than a 1% risk reduction there. You know, we've got studies on exercise, you know, Kaiser Permanente. They did a big meta-analysis. And again, even as I'm saying this, I understand it's observational data. This isn't like they're putting people through one group and another group, but it doesn't seem to matter today anyways. But they found 2.5% higher risk of death for people who are inactive. You can get quite a substantial decrease in your susceptibility just by being active, you know? And it's practical, it's free for the most part, you know? So, and also we know the side effects is just better health versus the side effects that are uncertain. So all of this is just bringing us back to this place of logic. So yeah, so that's what happened with the clinical trials. And as I mentioned, they unblinded the trials as well. There's so much corruption throughout it. And, you know, all of these adverse events, again, we did see some benefit in the beginning, But even that's waned. Because when it first all was approved, what happened? They were saying, first, you get the vax, you take off your mask. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to reduce transmission, right? It's going to reduce viral load. These are things like the CDC, the top person there was sharing, you know, and all these different, quote, health officials.
Do you think the actions that we've taken have done anything? Do you think that we would have a similar outcome? It's very hard to say, but do you think we'd have a similar outcome if we just did nothing? Like zero reaction? Like, okay, there's a virus floating around, you know?
Man, I mean, the data is pretty clear that our treatment of this virus is going to have, or already has, but especially as it bears out over years, far worse outcomes than the virus itself. Period. I'll give you a stat. Heart disease deaths. In 2020, so on average, 630,000 Americans die from heart disease each year. Mm-hmm. In 2020, it jumped up to almost 700,000 people die from heart disease. Mm-hmm. You don't hear shit about it, right? Why? Because we're less active. We're getting fatter now. The data already indicates this. We are more sleep deprived or abnormal sleep patterns, more stressed. Like all of these things, we've successfully made our society even worse just in 18 months, in 20 months. So now we're not just susceptible to infectious diseases. We're far more susceptible to all manner of diseases. And so, like I was saying, when it was first approved, they were saying, they were literally on the news. There's news clips that you can find with these things. It's decreasing your transmission rate, viral load. Now we have literally peer-reviewed evidence. And if you want, I could pull these up for everybody right now. But these are easy to go and find on Dr. Google, or DuckDuckGo is more of a better search engine in some aspects. But anyways, we know that one of these studies was just done, and it was a population of folks in, I don't want to say Montana, but I believe it's Maryland. Fuck.
I can start Googling or ducking. I've never even used it, but I'm going to use it now.
So actually, I'm gonna look it up because I want to actually cite this correctly, if that's okay. I don't know if you guys do edit.
Don't worry about it.
Doesn't matter.
We'll figure it out.
All right. Here we go. So it's vaccine data. Here we go.
I'd like to get to also, you know, when we're done kind of looking through a little bit of this, it seems like there's a lot of things that folks can do. And so I think when it comes to heart disease is always a real interesting one. I think that people don't really know how much can be done to counteract it. And I think that a lot of people think that, like I'm already overweight, like I'm just heading in that direction and there's like almost nothing you can do about it. You do hear about, you know, people that are athletic and people that are fit that occasionally, you know, drop dead here and there from just a heart attack, right? So I think a lot of times when it comes to some of these things, people put their hands up and think there's nothing we can do. We got to just wait for the pharmaceutical companies to come up with a cure or a solution for us.
Right, and we already know that their track record, for example, you know. And so here we go. This was, it was Wisconsin, Madison. So I think I said Maryland and Montana. Maryland. So it was Wisconsin, Madison. This was a collaborative study by researchers at the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, analyzing the viral load of SARS-CoV-2 positive samples collected from 83 individuals in Wisconsin. The scientists divided the participants into two groups, the fully vaccinated group with 32 individuals and the unvaccinated group with 51 individuals, and found no significant difference in viral load in the two groups. That's what they said. You get the vax, you take off your mask because we got lower viral load. You got lower transmission. Now we know that the transmission is essentially the same. Some data does show that there is some reduced transmission, but the majority says otherwise. And also, you know, populations, other countries have been ahead of us, you know. And so being able to analyze and look at their data, like what's happening in other parts of the world, and we can see, we know what the trend is, that if you get an initial inoculation and you get some benefit, it tanks just within here. It's the data shows that, and this was published in the journal Nature, vaccine-induced reduction in viral load showed that the benefit, quote, vanishes within 2 to 6 months. And so that's why you got to get the booster, right? because that's the thing they were hanging on to. So it's not actually reducing transmission, right? It's not reducing your susceptibility to getting this thing. That's not a vaccine. That's what a fucking vaccine is supposed to do. Like it inoculates you. But they literally changed the definition of what a vaccine is. So now it's not just prevents. Now it's just adds protection, right? And so
it's a very strange time. Has a vaccine been proven to lessen the impact? Because that's something that we hear. Like it seems to have potentially lessened the impact of COVID-19.
So we had this pandemic of the unvaccinated, right? Where, you know, hospitals were being flooded with people who were not vaccinated. Now, there's two things here. And again, I'm open to that being what actually is true. But for me, I'm just like, show me the data. Let me see the hospital fucking records. Let me see where this is actually happening. And the great thing is, I'm one of the people, like, I have a network of physicians and nurses and people who, you know, are my friends and colleagues. So I can get, and what it was from all of their on the ground assessments was it's a mix. It was a mix. Some places higher rates were vaccinated, some places were, but this was months after the vaccines had rolled out and gotten in heavy use. What was happening with this pandemic of the unvaccinated was a framing thing where they were taking data from January when almost, a tiny percentage of the U.S. population was vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And they're adding that in. So January, February, March, still don't have a significant percentage of the population vaccinated. All of that is put together. And they're using that as just framing because there was a time when most people were unvaccinated. So, of course, it's going to be framed as people are unvaccinated. But here's where we are today. So let me just get to the point. So this was just published last week. And this is an op-ed. This was published in one of our most prestigious journals, The Lancet. The title is "The Epidemiological Relevance of the COVID-19 Vaccinated Population is Increasing." What the researcher demonstrated was that about 60% of the folks, of the cases of COVID are now affecting folks who are vaccinated. Here in the United States, I don't got to make this up.
All right.
You know, and so again, the promise was these things wouldn't happen. But then there's this important science of antibody-dependent enhancement as well that's being overlooked. This was published in one of the most prestigious journals, the Journal of Infection. And so the researchers were just, again, this was a hypothesis that was very well understood early on that if we're putting out a vaccine treatment in the middle of a pandemic with all these variants, it could possibly increase the susceptibility or the mutation variants of viruses as they get smarter because you're rolling this shit out when there's so many variants and different things taking place. Mm-hmm. And so, but people were just shunning this. Again, this is one of our most prestigious journals. This isn't just made up, you know. And the mistake is, and it's because of this simple mistake. They think that if you're just superficially looking at this and you want that to be not an issue, you would say, well, if an antibody-dependent enhancement was a thing, people would get sick easier. But that's not the whole story. It doesn't necessarily have to mean you get sick easier. This could just mean you contract the infection easier. Right. And then it has its way with you and you're carrying this and then you transmit it and it's helping it to develop more tricks. Right. And so, yeah, there's a lot of different issues that can kind of bring this up. And in the beginning, yes, we can see what was being shared was that reduced risk of severe outcomes. Right. But as time is going on, that's proving to not be the case, except in the very beginning, which, again, I'll give some credibility, but I still haven't seen myself. I haven't seen any hospital records that are indicating that this is actually the case. What a lot of this is happening is anecdotal where people are like, so I got COVID, you know, I'm vaccinated, I'm double vaccinated. I actually double vaccinated and booster, but I got COVID.
You?
No. I'm just giving an example. Literally, I just saw one today from this physician. It's published on a major news site. Mm-hmm. Doctor, triple vaccinated, got COVID, right? But then he's like, I'm glad I'm vaccinated because it would have been worse.
I'm like, mm-hmm. Yeah, higher.
How the fuck do you know that? Mm-hmm. How do you know that? That's just totally like we're abandoning our logic to help us to uplift what we believe to be true.
Yeah.
And I think, and I'm just going to share this with everybody. I know I've been a little bit passionate with this subject, but I want to implore people to exercise this muscle. And believe it or not, I promise you that I'm doing this on a daily basis. I'm also proactively looking for ways to be wrong. Because our story that we're propping up about how things are can block us from seeing good. It can block us from seeing solutions and truth. So I still have to be open to Pfizer being, you know, my boo. I have to be open to them being ethical and helpful. And I have to be open to the media being ethical and helpful. I have to be open to our politicians, you know, regardless of what side they're on, being ethical and solutions oriented. I have to be open to that stuff or I'm going to miss things. So I can come to a very grounded assessment of things because I'm open to being wrong. And everything that I've shared today is based on published peer-reviewed data. It might not feel good. It might not fit the narrative, but it exists. And one of the issues that we've had recently is we've become blinded. You know, we've become paradigm blinded in a sense. And so the more that we can open ourselves up and also be open to having conversations, open and having compassion for people who don't agree with you, and just being able to have logical discussions, talk about things without, like you said, it's been this campaign, like if you're not doing this, you're a bad person, versus like education and putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, love, you know, basic tenets that tend to make stuff work better.
Why do you think obesity, what makes obesity more, like why does that make it more dangerous to catch COVID? Is that the case with all viruses all the time, or is it unique to COVID?
That's a great question. This brings up the field, it's called immunometabolism. It's another growing field of science. And there's two parts to it. Part one is there's a metabolism of your immune cells, of your immune system itself, which is dramatically stifled when we venture into obesity. Because what is happening when what people tend to think is they're gaining fat, right? They're making new fat cells, but that's not how it works. Your fat cells are pretty fucking amazing. They can actually expand 1,000 times their volume. And so they can get filled up with these contents. And as that happens, they're kind of like trash bags in a sense, like no disrespect to the fat cells. But once these trash bags start to get too stretched, like they can break in a sense. I'm not saying, but when I say break, I'm using a parallel to saying what happens is it's setting off an inflammatory immune response. So the best data that we have is that when we venture into a state of being significantly overweight and obese, our fat cells are sitting on a kind of a false distress signal that we're infected, that you're already sick. And so your immune system is chronically just trying to fight off this infection that you're carrying. But what you're really carrying is excess energy that the body was not designed to carry for a significant amount of time. All right, so immunometabolism is the science regarding how our immune cells have a metabolism themselves that can be damaged with obesity. The other part is immunometabolism being the health of the person, the person's metabolism affecting your immune system. And that's one of the leading reasons why obesity is such a big risk factor, is that your immune system requires energy. And when your body's trying to manage all this excess, your mitochondria resources are just getting siphoned and pulled to address basically trying to keep you alive because you're carrying something abnormal on your frame. Right, so it's pulling away energy that would be needed to address this infection, if that makes sense. So it's really just this kind of metabolic soup, this metabolic confusion taking place that we're already, again, we have a pre-inflamed person meeting up with the virus that creates a inflammatory response in the body. So just to be clear, the virus itself, no virus, makes you sick. Your body makes you sick in response to the virus. Your experience of cold and flu symptoms, you know, difficulty breathing, inflammation, coughing, pain, that's your body's response trying to mount an adequate response to this virus and it taking over the machinery of your cells. Viruses are pretty fucking cool. Like, they're amazing. Like, people love zombie movies, but they're like, they make zombie cells, basically. They're not even alive. Viruses are not dead or alive. They infect your cell, and they make your cell start printing out more copies of it. That's pretty remarkable. But humans are what we call human cells. We've evolved with viruses and integrated their technology. Everybody in this room right now, every human being has over about 400 trillion virus particles in and on their body right now. Like, it's just a part of humanity, you know? So you have this microbiome, you have the virome. Viruses are not just like all bad. Like, that's another part of this thing. It's a scary thing. We wouldn't even be, the best theory that we have is where the, as far as where the human immune system came from, was it evolved from viruses. Your immune system itself is a fucking virus that's faced off against other viruses throughout our evolution. And just like cooperated together. That's what we're designed to do. Not to say that something can't be particularly nefarious, but, you know, so that's one of those understandings as far as like, how is this pro-inflammatory state and your body's response to any, if you come in contact with this particular condition, I did, he knows, he saw, you know, I got the, you know, my antibodies test or whatever. I didn't even know when I got it. I don't know when, I don't know. Zero symptoms. I don't know. I don't know when it happened. But that's not everybody, of course. But what's not being looked at is even people who, we have a significant obesity problem in our country. Most people didn't get that sick. The vast majority of people didn't get that sick or sick at all. Mm-hmm. We're talking like 8 to 9 out of 10 people. Like COVID, whatever, wherever it came from, whatever it is, it caused a problem, but it still sucked. It still wasn't that good at taking people out and causing a big problem. The question is not to negate, by the way, the damage that's been done.
Yeah.
Not to negate that. But the better question would be, instead of like, why is this, look at all the suffering. Let's just focus on this. It should be, let's look at all the people that are okay. How are 9 out of 10 people okay? How did almost 50% of these folks were asymptomatic? What is it about their immune system or their body or whatever it is that made them be able to just shed this thing off, brush it off, and keep it moving? You know, so it's a shift in our thinking. But that would take away from the thing about COVID, really, more so than anything we've ever experienced in our recent human history, is the marketing machine behind it. So much money's been made off of this. You know, I think you guys, did you see the CNN, Charlie Chester getting caught on the hot mic, you know, Project Veritas. So he's a technical director at CNN. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody is probably, you know, a lady, you know, it was a girl, but she got him on the mic and, you know, they're like out at restaurants, a couple of dates, and ask him, why did they put the death toll ticker up on the screen? And he's just like, COVID, it's gangbusters for ratings. And he's just like, when I see, and he's the technical director, one step below the director. And he said that sometimes when I come into work, I see that the number, and I'm looking at it, I'm just like, we should get that number higher. Why isn't it higher? And then he's like, I know that's wrong. There's something seriously wrong to think that because these are people. And then she asked him, and I think, again, I know the guy who runs Project Veritas, he follows me, so maybe he, I don't know, maybe they got this question from me. I don't know. But in the very beginning, when I saw that on TV, which I don't watch that shit, I saw it at my neighbor's house. I was like, why don't they have a survival ticker to put some context? Because this is literally just relegating human lives to numbers on a screen without any context. It's just ridiculously, you know, creates a lot of fear if you don't have any awareness. And so I'm just like, why don't they put a recovery ticker up? Because it would supersede, it would be so dramatic. You know, you see 1 billion people have recovered, and then you see, you know, 1 million lives lost, or whatever the case might be.
Do you personally think that those numbers are extremely exaggerated? That it could be half or even less than what has been estimated and reported, especially because in the beginning?
Yeah. I'm going to say this. I don't think that that matters, because the lives were lost. And it's this chemical soup of pain and suffering and disease, because 95% of the people who died with COVID-19 on their death certificate had an average of 4 pre-existing chronic diseases and or comorbidities. So we're just a ticking time bomb either way. You know, so you could say that our chronic diseases loaded the gun and COVID pulled the trigger, you know. So it's all kind of mixed together.
It'd be nice to know, though, the truth.
Yes, I absolutely agree. But because it was so politicized, and, you know, I got the opportunity to have physicians to share this in my network and colleagues. they were getting emails sent to them telling them how to code differently for COVID, like in way, like they've never seen that before. Like, why are you telling me, like the person, if they have heart disease or they have a heart attack, like why are you still telling me if to test them if they have COVID and put that on the death certificate? Like they're trying to, they had them to change the way that they're reporting stuff, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that it's a conglomeration of things. Definitely things have, I mean, there was a, for example, I like to stick to the data. So there was an incident in New York City, for example, where they just in a day, they added tens of thousands of deaths. And what it was, and this wasn't like the people died in a day, but they had had this kind of backlog that was added because people expressed symptoms of COVID, and they weren't tested. All right. This is early in this campaign. Again, this is all readily available data. And the thing is, what are the symptoms for COVID? Fucking everything, you know, just like how can you ethically add 30,000 deaths? Like we didn't even test these folks. So there's definitely been some of that for sure. Again, I think it's an issue, but I'm not going to be in this camp of like, you know, COVID doesn't exist. But I think that the power that we've given COVID, that we've given this name to this thing has become this, it's much more powerful than the thing itself. You know, literally our fear of it is killing people.
Yeah.
The CDC published this shit. Second leading risk factor for death is anxiety and fear-related disorders. You can't make that up.
One of the first people we had come on the show in talking about COVID, we all kind of laughed because of the way that he said it, and the guy had an accent, but he, we were like, what do you think this is? And he said, Zuckerberg. Mm. he just kind of meant like he thinks it's a social media virus, you know, that it went viral and that's why we're in this position. And he said that, like, I mean, this is like a year and a half ago probably that this guy said that. And I was like, wasn't far off, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's definitely, and it also, if you look at the disparity, I just published today, actually. I was looking at it on the plane on the way over. And so, which is what we already know, but the gap between people in poverty and the wealthy has expanded since COVID started. It's just like, no shit, you know? But this is what we saw coming. You know, these folks who are billionaires, they made so much more money. Not to say, again, get your money, but it's the ethics behind it. You know, they're able to leverage and take advantage of this opportunity. A lot of pharmaceutical players, of course, have become billionaires or expanded their empires, you know, while people who are like, if I wasn't the person that I am today and I was living the reality that my son, when he was born, that I was living in, man, I would have been fucked. Like, he would have been. We have the ability to pay for a computer, to pay for somebody to be on homeschooling with my son when everything shut down. Millions of children just in Los Angeles alone didn't have access to proper education. And the whole thing that's supposed to level this playing field is access to education, right? And so some kids, it's their one shot to get out of the hood, the place that I come from. I was just sharing with my youngest son, like, because we went to see the Serena, King Richard. And there was a scene.
Great movie.
Yeah, man. There was a scene where the drive-by happened, right? And so, spoiler alert, I'm sorry. Sorry, I should have said spoiler alert. But, and my son was just so, like, that's what the first thing he talked about when we left. I'm like, you didn't see the story of, like, you know, this triumph and all this. He's like, why did that happen so fast? Why did that happen? I'm just like, where I'm from, literally, like, I shared one example. I was walking with my friend. His name was Frog. And this car stops at the top of the block. I could see the guns. And he took off. He was gone. I just laid down. I was right by a car. I just laid down. They actually didn't fire off that time. But I guess they were looking for somebody, you know. But that's the only time I've been like right there where I could die. But, you know, just, I mean, at least every week we're hearing, you know, somebody getting shot at, the sirens, that kind of thing. Living in that reality, it's literally a risk for me to go outside and play basketball. But we did. We had to live and have fun and kind of have some sense of normalcy. But if you're in that environment, most people in the United States don't understand. Well, people who are okay, like in safe conditions, they don't understand that's the reality for somebody like myself, you know. And so for me to come from that place is so much more difficult because I just got to try to survive to make it to my fucking bus stop, right? Now, once I get here at this institution of education, I was in what's called the, quote, DSEG program. So I'm getting bused out to the good school from our neighborhood. And now the playing field can sort of, now it's like I can get this education, I can engage, I can learn, I could do well in school, and I can get scholarships. Like, it opens the possibility for me. And also with athletics, you know, like a lot of kids didn't get their shot, their senior year of high school. I admit that might have been his one shot to be able to play at the next level, you know. Maybe it had been building up and this was his time.
I personally think it's important that we reframe, you know, our thinking around some of this, because in my opinion, it's not because of COVID. Mm-hmm. People often will say it's because of this happened because of COVID. And I think that it happened because of our response to COVID. And I think it's, to me personally, again, people can feel differently and that's totally fine. It's up to them. Everyone has an opinion. Yeah. But that's where my opinion stands. And I think it's very unfortunate. And then we kind of continue to keep propagating this over and over again. So because we're still in it, and who knows how long we'll be in it, and who knows how long...
you got the Megatron variant.
Yeah, mandates and all those different things. And yeah, like new things coming down the pipeline. What are actionable things that people can do? Because your background in nutrition and health, I think, comes in massively. Obviously, we got sleep. Obviously, we have a couple things we can do food-wise. But like, there's some staggering stats out there about what happens to an individual when they lose like 10% of their body fat.
Yeah.
Which for someone that is 300 pounds, for them to lose approximately 30 pounds, you and I and probably everybody in this room has seen folks that weigh 300 pounds. We've seen them lose 30 pounds. I don't want to say easily, but we've seen them lose 30 pounds relatively quickly, 6 to 8 weeks. Maybe it would take someone a little longer. Maybe it takes a couple months. Yeah. This thing is probably going to drag on for more months or be around for more months. What happens when an individual just loses even just 5-10% of their body fat?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this parlays into that final point, which is the opposite has happened, where we have higher rates of obesity now, especially in our kids. And so kids not having access to being able to go to school, place of safety, consistency, to be able to travel along and take advantage of education, now they're far behind, a year behind, 2 years, and most likely will never, quote, catch up. Like, we've disadvantaged an entire generation of children who come from where I come from, disadvantaged children. And also they're also the ones who are experiencing the worst as far as the obesity as well. Now, here's the good news, all right? Because even within that, that I come from that. I get to be here with you guys. I get to make and share my life, my education, my research to empower people, to help people, to help to create more dope human beings. Because I come from those terrible circumstances, something really great came from it. You know, I have perspective. I have an audacity to stand up in the face of anything, you know? So I believe that what's happening right now for our children and even for ourselves, but largely for these kids, this is their Great Depression. Like, you guys have probably been seeing this quote coming and going around about good times creating weak men, weak men creating hard times creating strong men, and the cycle just going on and on and on. I believe that this is that time where these hard times, where it's going to develop the character and capacity. I know that it can go the opposite. It can get more fucked up. I know that, but I really believe that. Just looking at the cycles of life, studying history, this is going to create innovation, because people are going to look at this and say, no, this is not okay. Wait a minute. We've been allowing our society to become this sick and we just have these people over here profiting? Or wait a minute. The United States was built on the number one principle here is freedom of speech. And we've allowed all these different things to happen to censor our speech and our ability to communicate with each other and education and censoring scientists and the whole list goes on and on. No, I'm not going to allow that. And so it's going to force that innovation of change. So what can folks do? Again, I believe that this is giving us a huge opportunity. Just by losing that amount of body fat, as you mentioned, we're going to, number one, the first thing that's going to happen is dramatic decrease in inflammation. Mm-hmm. I had this patient I was working with, a young woman. She was in her mid-late 20s. She had just had her youngest of three children. She had three boys, beautiful kids. And she got diagnosed with terminal cancer, breast cancer. And her name's Christy. And actually, I have her before and after of her breast cancer scans on my site, by the way, because I don't fuck around. Like, yeah. These are the things, it's just like seeing is believing. And so she came in. Her father actually is the one, I think maybe he, I don't know, came to one of my lectures or something like that, but is the one who referred her. And we put her on to a protocol. Major change. First, we got to identify, like, where is the potentiality with, first of all, I mean, I don't want to get too much into this, but carcinogens, like they're cancer-causing agents. There's going to be a tendency towards cancer growing and developing if you're engaging with some type of carcinogens. So anyway, so we did a lot to like remove possible carcinogens from her life, bring in a lot of anti-cancer therapies and implements. And 30 days later, she got a breast cancer scan done and her breast tumor was significantly smaller. But I'm bringing this up to say this. What happened, though, was you could see in the initial scan, like her fucking, her liver was like lit up. Around her adrenals was just like super hot. Like it looked like it was just like they were inflamed and on fire. And then you could see this 30 days later and you could see there's less of her because you can also see the outline of her body. There's less of her, but all this inflammation was gone. Like that flame, the fire, all that, the stuff that was lit up 30 days prior, that was gone. And she's a... long story short, she's alive and well today, by the way. And I didn't want to make this about, again, this is a hard thing to understand. And I worked along with her doctor. We did some hormone therapy as well. But these are the things that are possible. So we're going to reduce inflammation. We're going to dramatically decrease your susceptibility to severe reactions because your body isn't already trying to fight an infection. And the other thing is really basic, simple principles, and I could just go through a list of them and some peer-reviewed data on it as well. But let me give a simple one. Since we're right here and we just actually had this before the show, there was a peer-reviewed study looking at sodium and potassium and electrolytes in COVID patients. And they found that folks who were deficient in electrolytes had a far greater risk of severe outcomes and hospitalization. Oh, that's Mark, it's not me. Far higher risk of severe outcomes from COVID when they're deficient in electrolytes. Mm-hmm. Something so simple, foundational to human health. Why aren't we talking about this? Yeah. Now, the study did not disclose whether it's the deficiency in electrolytes that led to the worst outcomes or did COVID cause the depletion of the electrolytes. Either way, the electrolytes are critical because they're helping the body to mount a defense, a response. These electrolytes are running... pretty much every process in your body requires a sodium potassium pump mechanism. Everything to fucking happen. And so if you're deficient in sodium and potassium, in the right ratios, guess what? Your body's going to be far less resilient or capable of mounting an appropriate response. And that's the key with COVID and any of this other stuff. It's mounting an appropriate response, not this quote cytokine storm and overreacting or not underreacting, right? And so getting your electrolytes, so getting yourself properly hydrated. And I swear to God, people can actually go and Google. There's actually a study with COVID and dehydration as well. There are scientists who are asking this question, who are asking these important questions. There's another study published in the journal Gut, found that folks who experienced higher susceptibility and more severe effects from COVID had more gut dysbiosis. So if you're coming in, let's get your gut healthy. The number one thing for that, remove the shit that's fucking up your gut in the first place, right? So pesticides, abnormal food stuffs, you know, just all this basic stuff that you guys talk about, you know, so reducing the amounts of processed foods we're exposed to and increasing friendly flora, the number one way to do that, I talk about this in Eat Smarter, my latest book, the number one way to improve your microbiome diversity is to improve the diversity of the foods that you're eating. Because every single microbe needs something to eat. Mm-hmm. And different microbes eat different things. When your gut microbiome diversity goes down, obesity goes up. microflora diversity goes down, insulin resistance goes up. Everything, there's an inverse relationship. And modern day humans here in the United States, for example, versus hunter-gatherers have 4 times less bacteria diversity. Clearly a problem. Mm-hmm. And so, again, a published study found that worse COVID outcomes when you have dysbiosis, more pathogenic bacteria. So add in, we tend to, even if we're eating healthy, we tend to eat the same shit.
Sure.
Mix it up, add in some different foods to improve your diversity in your flora. Also, this gives you an opportunity to get in some new nutrients from different foods. You know, just start stacking conditions. So last thing is, obviously, sleep is critical, you know, especially now more than ever. And there's peer-reviewed studies. One of them is published in the BMJ, looking at sleep-deprived motherfuckers and COVID. And finding, again, guess what? Just by getting, we'll just say the person is getting 5 hours of sleep. By bumping it up 1 hour, reduce their susceptibility to COVID by 12%. They found it, I believe it was like a 12% correlation. Every hour you get added an additional 12% protection, right? But they're not getting on TV and telling you this, you know? So yeah, again, basic stuff. And let's create an environment where these are normal. Mm-hmm. Let's normalize movement. Let's normalize getting high quality sleep. Let's normalize education and freedom of speech and engagement, you know? So I'm excited about what we can do, but, you know, we got a big job ahead of us.
You guys good?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want this to end, but yeah, I just...
We smoke through a lot of
stuff. Yeah, a lot. And I'm just thinking, you know, there's going to be a lot of comments like, oh, look at the science, but like what you had said about the, it was like the 1.1% being an effective dose, or I forgot how you even put it, about the...
absolute risk reduction?
Yes, thank you, sir. And it's just like... fuck. Like it, I'm just, where do you guys, is it just the news, the media is creating like all this misinformation that like, cause you could literally put that right in front of somebody's face, explain everything you just did. And they're still going to be like, no, I'm going to take the vaccine because I want to protect myself and my community because the science says so. Yeah. It's like, but does it though?
Yeah.
So how are we going to change that?
I think we need to get to a place, it's always just finding an opening, you know? So I've been trying to leverage all these different positions. Like, here's the FDA. Here's some truth about that. Here's some truth about pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. Start to chip away at the belief system around it. But most importantly, it's just allowing people to, just understanding that people are going to believe what they want to believe. It's more important to focus on yourself right now, getting yourself healthy, your family, you know, the people in close proximity who are with you, and, you know, talking to people who want to know, and who, you know, don't spend too much time going back and forth trying to make somebody see something that they don't want to see. You know, one of my, they call themselves one of my biggest fans. They work for Johnson & Johnson, and I posted some data about Johnson & Johnson. They're like, Sean, I love you, been listening for years. But when you talk about Johnson & Johnson, it really makes me feel, you know, fill in the blank, like, you know, I'm not liking you or whatever it is. And I was just like, listen, and I shared a quote, and I believe it was Mark Twain, that it's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it, right? Mm-hmm. And so when folks are already so bought in, I think it's important for them to at least just, let's have this foundational conversation of like, when the science says, what science? And science is never definitive. That's the biggest thing. It's never definitive. Science is always evolving and changing, and that's beautiful. So to say that the science is clear on something, I promise you it's not. I promise you it's not. But again, this is complex terrain. Mm-hmm. Another thing from Joe Dispenza, you know, is like that kind of that tipping point, you know, and understand there's a certain population of people when they imbibe an idea or a certain way of thinking, it affects the entire population, you know? So, yeah, I mean, we got work to do, man, but I did, again, it's just time to really focus in on ourselves, on your own health and your own wellness, be an example, demonstrate it, show what's possible.
Yeah. Well, since Mark just bounced, for Jordan, for yourself, this is going to totally change up the topic, but for you and your siblings, you know, with your guys' culture at home, you know, you're probably not having like cupcakes around the house and that sort of thing. When you were growing up, did you feel like you were missing out on anything? Cause you're like, oh, like my buddy down the street, they have pizza 2 times a week. Like how come we don't have that?
That's kind of funny. My situation is kind of unique in the sense of I went from my dad's house, which is, you know, the healthy structure, to my mom's house, which is like whatever. So I had both. Yeah. But there was a time when my dad was like super hard on being vegan and raw food is, where I would come over and I'd be like,
come on, dad.
It would be bad. Like, I couldn't wait to go to Whole Foods and see the samples out. I'm like, I'm going to get some chips while he's not looking. Like, it was. But, yeah, I had like a balance between both, honestly.
That's cool.
But just to clarify, I've experimented with every diet framework you can imagine.
How long did you do the vegan thing?
Man, maybe 4 years.
Four years?
Wow. How was that? Vegan and raw food is.
I did raw food for maybe 2 to 3 years.
100%.
I lived in Missouri, man. It was cold, man. Like, it was terrible. It was terrible. But it was just like, I got to see what this does. And initially, again, a lot of different diets, they feel good in the beginning, like, you know. And what it was for me was I was just more pulling away from the processed foods that I was eating.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was feeling good, you know. But you've got another big takeaway for folks today is that everybody is unique. And so in my clinical practice, in the beginning, if I was doing something, I would have the patients I was working with do it. So if I'm vegan, you're vegan. If I'm keto, you're keto.
Mm-hmm.
Versus me paying attention to what they need right now and honoring them. Mm. And I start to even like analyze, see what kind of data I can get on their ancestry. You know, like you've got your ancestors migrated here from Kenya. You know, what did your grandmother eat? Like just inquiring, having a good time, and then actually this nostalgia comes up and you can see, okay, well, you guys are eating some goat. Maybe we add in a little bit. You do like goat? Yeah, I love goat. I don't get it that often. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Nyama, you know. My wife is actually from Kenya. But being able to see that, you know, there's this connective tissue. And what if you eat things that your ancestors have been eating for a long time?
Yeah.
You know? So paying attention to that versus my dogma. Again, so when I'm saying that I proactively work at being wrong, I'm not just saying that. Like, plus I have a wife, so... Like, I have a lot of experience of being wrong at home. And so here's the crazy thing. When you work on being wrong, you end up being right a whole lot more often. Because as I'm looking at the data, I'm looking for, how am I wrong here? Like, what is this data telling me? Because it might say what I want it to say. But let me find how this doesn't hold true in this other context.
And something to add on. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No,
to what you were saying, something my dad did also do, is he showed me that if I say I wanted to have pizza, he wouldn't get it from, not to like disrespect, like Pizza Hut or Domino's. He get it from somewhere like Whole Foods. Just like give me a better option. Like if I wanted a burger, he wouldn't give me McDonald's. He'll like possibly like make the burger instead. Yeah, yeah. You know,
that's cool. I like that. And then Sean, sorry, I know I promise this is it. But since you've been open and talking about like just literally stating facts and studies and all this stuff, how has it affected your YouTube, your podcast, social media, and that sort of thing? Have you noticed like a huge drop in engagement and that sort of thing?
Yeah. So you guys are the first people that I've shared this with, as far as like not people who just in my team.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, this doesn't come without a risk. You know, especially in the terrain that we're in, and you know, my podcast is. I've been the number one health podcast in the United States many, many times. I'm so grateful for that. But the audio platform has not been an issue. But the video platform, I moved to Los Angeles to get on that video, on the vids, man. And so we were about to start really investing in it, and everything was going amazing. And the person that I work with, as I mentioned to you guys, he manages some of the other biggest channels, like on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And he reached out to us because I'm one of those personalities that when I was on these different top shows, it'd be in their top 0.5% of their views. Like, you know, and so I was basically making these folks a lot of money. And the guy was just like, you were one of these guys, these top 10 personalities. Let's build your channel. So he could see all of their metrics. He could see their watch time. He could see their conversion, click-through rates, all that stuff. And so everything was going amazing until I started talking about some of the stuff around COVID, again, just going through some peer-reviewed data and a meta perspective of different things. And then all of a sudden, YouTube stopped recommending my videos. This was after they took one of my videos down. And I know, of course, they didn't have a scientist who actually reviewed the data, clearly, or anybody who was remotely equipped or qualified to understand the data that I was sharing, but it's because it didn't fit the narrative. And so after that, yeah, YouTube stopped recommending my videos, whereas, you know, I might have a friend of mine who's making maybe six figures from their YouTube channel. Mine is far from that now, you know, so I have sacrificed multiple six figures for sure with that medium. But here's the thing. I don't give a fuck. I don't care. It's right. What's right is right. Fuck YouTube. No offense if anybody might happen to see this on YouTube. Not fuck you. Fuck YouTube. Respectfully, you know, I know that they're doing their thing. They believe that they're trying to somehow help and serve this mission. But we have to have the audacity to be like, you know what? If you're trying to limit me for being who I am and doing what I feel called to doing what's right and not out here being nefarious and hurting people or propagating any kind of conspiracy theories, just somebody who's a scientist with 20 years of experience. And literally, your doctor probably has my book in his office. You know, like yeah. Maybe I have a little bit of credibility here to share some insights on this. And so with that happening, again, it's just forced innovation and creativity for me, because the same thing started to happen with on Instagram as well. You know, everything started blowing up, you know, like I never really put much into Instagram. So I had like maybe, I don't know, 80,000 followers pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And I just dabble in there. I still kind of dabble, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But then like I started sharing this content, you know, data and, you know, videos jumped up to 200,000, like in a few months. And then it went down, Instagram went down and whatever, when that happened, it just hasn't rebounded. You know, it crawled. Like I was having at least 1,000 new followers each day. Now it's like 100, you know, it's like 10 times. Is that 90% less growth? But I think again, like that can happen with any platform, anytime. I'm not going to blame this, but they have censored, put the little misinformation things on my tag. There's one video, a recent one that I did. They put this misinformation warning, and they put the words that I literally said as a disclaimer in the video. Like I literally said, because I was talking about the VAERS database, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. And I was just like, this does not denote causality. Just because it's reported to VAERS does not denote causality. I said it twice in the video, but they put the misinformation, VAERS report does not denote causality of a vaccine reaction. Anyways, but what I did was I was finding a creative way to share the fact that about 2/3 of the adverse events reported in VAERS are women. All right, number one. Number two, there's been this increased incidence, which now, as of this recording today, the NIH has launched a multimillion dollar fund to study the effects of abnormalities taking place with women's menstrual cycles post-vaccination. Tens of thousands of women have reported this. There are thousands reported in VAERS, but also just women took to social media. It was a big, this happened back in like April, February, January. These reports were happening, but they just now, I'm talking in September, November, October. So I think this was October when they launched the NIH to actually investigate. Oh, well, you know what? We're going to throw a couple million dollars here because a lot of women are saying this thing is happening. That should have been done in the beginning. But I was finding a creative way to do that by Nicki Minaj's story, which is just, you know, it's crazy. Like she was like, I didn't go to the Met because they wanted me to get vaccinated. And my cousin's best friend's ball swole up after he got vaccinated. He is impotent now. His wife left, you know, his girlfriend, fiance left him. It sounds crazy. It sounds insane. So I'm just like, Nicki's Minaj, you know, I'm just like, this sounds crazy, you know, and I played a clip from, you know, Anthony Fauci saying that, and this was Jake Tapper, asking him like, does this have any grounds? Would a abnormal reproductive system occurrence take place? And Fauci was like, there's no scientific grounds for anything like that, nor is there any mechanistic reason why that would happen. That was his exact words. I just want to support Dr. Fauci's sentiment here because this sounds absolutely crazy. Let's check out the VAERS database. And so then I pull it up on screen so everybody could see it, and they could see that there's almost 700,000 adverse events reported. And I went through the 80 reported testicle swelling up of these guys and their stories. You know, I didn't go through all 80, but some of them were fucking crazy. And these happened like back in January and February. It wasn't just like after Nicki Minaj came out and said it. People were literally reporting it. A lot of them were just like, nobody told me that this was an adverse reaction. I just thought I should share. Or some of them were reported by healthcare workers who were with the patient and they reported themselves. And so it's just like, yeah, this has happened. It's not like there was impotency. Impotency, you know, basically it's not working. All right. So there was over 100 reports of that. If I'm going to do my social duty, my civic duty, and next thing I know, I can't hit the booty, that's a problem. At least tell me, you know? And so, and that's just something people have the right to know. Mm-hmm. Not to say that this is a thing that happens frequently, but it exists. And so, and also in that database for abnormal, because he asked Fauci about women's abnormalities with their sexual reproductive system, with their reproductive system. And he said, again, for men and women, there's no grounds or mechanistic reason as to why this would be a thing. Cut to that motherfucker. No, I'm sorry. This individual works the NIH. He's at the NIH. And they literally launched a multi-million dollar study to study the menstrual abnormalities taking place. That's not okay. Like, it's the NIH who's paying for the investigation into this because it is a thing. Mm-hmm. But you're on national television telling people it's not a thing. Mm-hmm. What does that do to the people who have experienced these things? Like, it just makes them feel insane. And like, there are people literally that, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but people have been, you know, suicide rates have gone up. You know, people mm-hmm. who are not, they're not being acknowledged and they're being led to believe that they're crazy because they've spoken out. Mm-hmm. I think is, you know, Aubrey Marcus, you know, mm-hmm. he just had on the guy who's a professional, I think he's like a champion mountain biker, mm-hmm. you know, and again, he was just trying to get vaccinated. He felt a little bit of pressure to do it. He just wanted to be able to tour and all this stuff. His career might be over, you know, because of myocarditis and inflammation of his heart, some other really strong conditions that he was dealing with. He didn't care to be a face of this stuff, but he just sharing what happened, that what made him an advocate. He wasn't trying to be an advocate. He just shared what happened and then he got censored. And he was like, why would they do that? And so that made people look into it more. Mm-hmm. That's another inspiring thing about now is that it's making people who are just like, just scientists, I'm just sharing the data, I'm just a physician sharing data, but then they get attacked. Mm-hmm. That makes them dig even deeper and they start finding out the real shit, you know? So, yeah, man.
So, oh, fuck, sorry, I know I said I was done, but infertility, that was another big scare for a lot of people. I know people in my family that they've been doing whatever it takes to not get vaccinated because they do want kids.
Yeah.
Has there been any studies showing that, yeah, it does infect for male and female reproduction system?
What I can share factually is that, again, the VAERS database, which is co-run by the FDA and the CDC, it's poorly managed, but it's a federal offense to put a false report. And this was prior to any of this stuff happening with people even caring about VAERS. But there are hundreds of women who've reported spontaneous miscarriages. And these are women who just, and many of them, they just, the perspective, and it's really heartbreaking to go through and read their stories mm-hmm. because they seem so detached. They're just like, I can't say for certain, but, you know, I was 2 months pregnant. And then, you know, the week after I got vaccinated, I had a miscarriage, you know. And so again, because we can't say causality, and that's the open loop that we have with these drugs is that you could literally just make it so that nothing is ever an adverse reaction. It's all a coincidence, you know. And so as far as that's concerned, I mean, this was, again, I can't say for certain because we don't have the data. But what I can say for certain is that when it was analyzed, where are these lipid nanoparticles, where are they sequestering in the body? The highest place, one of the highest places, and I showed my son the data actually, was women's ovaries. So it was just like, really sequestering and kind of conforming and being attracted to women's ovaries for some reason. This is probably why there's such an increased incidence of abnormalities with menstrual cycles. And again, what was happening is like, yeah, well, just, you know, make sure that you bring an extra pad or a heavy flow when you go and get your vaccine, you know, for that week, you know, whatever. Just why? Why would it do that to your reproductive cycle? Like, that's not okay. What are the long-term ramifications? Because what it is, and the question, the thing is, How? How can this create abnormalities with blood flow, for example? Well, these nanoparticles, you know, these spike proteins that it's getting triggered to get made in the body, it's moving throughout our bloodstream, period. So wherever the blood goes, any of these organs can be potentially harmed. You know, the spike protein, which is well established now, is harmful in and of itself, whether it's COVID-derived or vaccine-derived, you know. And it's not just something that's just so, like, inert and doesn't do anything. We got to stop acting like that's the case. So I'm not going to say conclusively that that's a, I hope not. I mean, that would be terrible, obviously. But more so the things that are getting shared are people who are having healthy pregnancies and healthy births. That's amazing. But there are also people who are not experiencing that. And they deserve to have their stories shared as well.
Take us on out of here, Andrew.
Yeah, I'll shut the fuck up. Sorry. Thank you, everybody, for checking out today's episode. Wherever you're watching this, please support this show. Please support this episode. Like it. Subscribe to this channel. And make sure you share this with somebody that needs to see it. Based on everything that we've heard today and based on the way some of these platforms work, we might need the support. I'm not going to beg you for it, but it would be sincerely appreciated. And also, please follow the podcast at Mark Bell's Power Project on Instagram, at MB Power Project on TikTok and Twitter. My Instagram and Twitter is at I am Andrew Z, at The Andrew Z on TikTok. And Seema, where are you at?
And Seema Yin Yang on Instagram and YouTube, and Seema Yin Yang on TikTok and Twitter. Sean and Jordan.
At Real Jordan on Instagram.
How did you get, you got Real Jordan? Like, nobody else had that?
Is that
like,
L and L or is it an I? Is it Real?
It's just Real.
R-E-A-L-J-O-R.
Yeah,
oh,
you Real really Jordan. That's fucking amazing.
J-O-R-D-E-N.
Oh, okay.
And Dad, you know, one of your jobs as a father is to be protective of your son. How are you protecting him against all the pussy that's out there?
I'm going to plead the fifth. I've talked about a lot of stuff today.
Good looking kid, you know, you got to be careful.
Yeah, I mean, right? Just values, man. Just values, you know. That's it. That's all I can give him.
Where are you at?
Great stories. Learn through your lessons.
Right. Yeah. No, for real. For real. I'm at Sean Model on Instagram. It's S-H-A-W-N-M-O-D-E-L on Instagram. I pop in and do a little tweet every now and then. I'm at Sean Model there as well. But Instagram is where I frequent the most.
Thank you guys so much for your time. And I thought that was really an interesting way of putting it, because when you talked about the pandemic, oftentimes people will say, oh, yeah, like that dude was around during the time of the Great Depression. And they say it as a positive because they say, like, that hardened that individual. Like, he knows what it's like to go through some tough times or some hard shit. And maybe in the future people will say that about the pandemic. That guy was, you know, around the time of the pandemic. Remember that shit? And, you know, so hopefully some positive will come of it. Maybe it'll make people stronger in the long run, and maybe it will make us question the authority, which is always a good idea. Thank you guys so much again for your time. Really appreciate it. Strength is never a weakness. Weakness is never strength. Catch you guys later.